broadcasting from Dublin, Ireland, and around the world on TalkingBrawlsMMA.com and iTunes. You're listening to Ireland's premier mixed martial arts show, the Talking Brawls Mixed Martial Arts Podcast.
This is Mike Dolce,
Ian McCall, James Little Evil Pulver,
the Crippler Chris Levin, and you're listening to
Talking Brawls.
We are back to Talking Brawls Mixed Martial Arts Podcast with your host, as always, Niall McGrath. And obviously, back on today with me is Andrew McGann. Andrew, how are things? How are you keeping, bro?
I'm officially now Severe MMA's second blue belt behind Peter Carroll.
I was just about to mention that. Big congratulations. Andy received his blue belt on Wednesday night, or was it last night?
Yeah,
the night before?
Wednesday night.
Great stuff. You must be over the moon, Andrew.
Oh, very pleased. It's my trainer wasn't really consistent, so took a little bit longer than some people I know, but the last maybe 6 to 8 months just training very hard for a lot of tournaments. Was very pleased to be promoted alongside two guys that train with me, a guy called Ryan McCartney and Marcin Zembella. The two of those are just in my weight division or the weight division above, so when they like to compete a lot as well, so it's nice to get recognized and promoted alongside the people that are there with you day in, day out, staying longer or coming early, and it's nice.
Big congratulations to you, Andy. Over the moon for your brother. It's great news. Okay, on the show today, obviously, we have a lot to talk about. It's been a busy week yet again in the world of mixed martial arts. First off, we're going to talk a little bit about UFC 170. Ronda Rousey retaining her belt against Sarah McMahon in dominance, but yet slightly controversial circumstances. We'll talk about that in a few minutes' time. Also, we have to talk about Cage Warriors Fighting Championships number 65 this weekend at the Helix here in Dublin, Ireland. Also, UFC China on Saturday morning. I believe it starts at 8 a.m. Eastern time, so about 1 p.m. GMT here in Ireland. Also on the show today, we've a great guest on the show. We've Jack Encarnacio. Jack joined myself and contributor to the show here and the website, Joe Riley, to talk about the business side of mixed martial arts. Really interesting stuff on what the year holds for the UFC on the business sense in 2014. And also on the show today, a great interview, an in-depth interview with Ken Shamrock. He talks about everything, about the early days, about steroids, about the UFC, Dana White, and obviously his recent comments yet again about the UFC not treating the fighters with the respect that he believes they deserve. So, Andrew, first off, let's get to it. Let's get right to it. And obviously, sorry, if you want to hit us up, obviously you can catch Andrew on severemma.com at Andrew McGahan _. You can catch me at Niall McGrath 4 and at TBMMADOTCOM on Twitter. And obviously the website, www.talkingbrawlsmma.com. Andrew, what did you make of the fight last Saturday, Rousey and McMahon? I'm under the impression, I feel that the fight was stopped a little bit too early. What was your feeling on the Rousey McMahon fight?
I shared the same view initially as a lot of people, and I think it's just when you get caught up in the moment of watching a fight, and I don't think that people were angered at the stoppage more so than they were angered at that they wanted to see a longer fight, especially considering how good the Rory McDonald how good the whole card was. And then the last two fights were a little bit of a letdown in terms of quick finishes and one-sidedness. I think people were more annoyed at that.
Herb's really been in the spotlight lately, obviously with the Uriah Faber fight against Henan Barrow. Got a lot of criticism for that. He was in charge of Rousey McMahon. And obviously, just the thing that sort of bothers me is the lack of consistency. We saw earlier on in the night, we saw Mike Pyle defeat TJ Wahlberger. And, you know, TJ probably took 10 unanswered shots on the deck, and Herb probably should have stopped that a lot earlier. And, you know, we've seen the Rousey McMahon fight, you know, the complete opposite.
Yeah, well, to be honest, if we could just go local for a minute, just when you talk about unanswered shots, I saw a young guy called Huey O'Rourke take about 20 unanswered shots from Dylan Toke Dillon had his back at Battlezone. And something that I've been sitting on for a little while, you know, like Herb gets the benefit of the doubt because he's so experienced. But Stephen Burke, who was refereeing the fight, I've seen him now referee a lot of matches in Ireland. And to be honest, I don't know how events are still allowing him to ref. I know it's all a learning experience and a learn. You're going to get better. But why should you get better at the sake of someone taking 10 or 15 unanswered shots? It was absolutely ridiculous. The fight should have been stopped at least 30 seconds before it did. Dillon said it in the post-fight interview that he thought it should have been stopped beforehand. Yeah. Huey just kind of lay on the ground for a few minutes afterwards, just probably compiling himself. And if we're all like, I genuinely wasn't going to, I was talking to Fig O'Farrell and he's like, oh, are you going to talk about this now? And I was like, well, I really should have been taking notes and all the other times, but I don't know how many times I've left an Irish event thinking, how is that guy allowed to referee? And like, I understand people get better and refereeing is not an easy job at all. But
yeah, it's obviously going to put the fighters, you know, health in jeopardy with situations like that. And you know, ultimately,
it's not even that. Like, obviously, it is that. But these guys are amateurs, and they shouldn't be getting extra smacks or extra shots in an amateur bout when really they're just getting used to it. Like in professional, I do understand maybe letting it go on until there's no doubt in terms of an early stoppage because they're getting paid. But like these guys are 17, 18 and they're competing amateur, and it's just, it was uncomfortable to watch a young guy take so many unanswered shots. And I really hope referees,
yeah, cop on to it. Yeah,
not even copped on, but it's like people aren't just gonna.
You know, what can be done here? You know, should there be more training? Should there be more, you know, seminars and courses for these referees?
Well, I tweeted Mark Goddard before because Mark Goddard does an excellent refereeing and judging course. And he said, if you can get me, I think it was 12 people, he'll do it. I think it's definitely something that people should look into organizing before the next Cage Warriors and the Helix in June, because like Peter Lavery is a great ref. Dave Jones is a great ref. And Dec Larkin is a great ref. Outside of that, I can't think of anyone who I would feel all right refereeing it. Like, it seems like I'm on a one person witch hunt here, singling out Stephen Burke. But if it's happened so many times, then
yeah, there's definitely an issue there. If it is happening, you know, more than it should. Just getting back to Rousey McMahon, Andrew. You know,
of course.
What's going on with Herb recently? It's there seems to be a lot of inconsistency in his officiating.
Yeah, I think Herb was like, I don't know if you saw the tweet, but Herb actually left the octagon shaking his head.
Yeah, I saw that.
Maybe because he thought, I'm going to get a bit of stick for this. Sarah McMahon went down like she had been shot and was in fairness, was working her way back up. The real issue, I think, is that some referees are not judging the fight as they should. Now, I don't believe, oh, it's a title fight, it should go on longer. I don't think a stoppage should be allowed to go on for any longer because it's a title fight. However, I think Herb, the other guys, may just still be getting a little bit used to seeing women fight. And, you know, seeing a woman drop like that and then get shots and, oh, you have to stop it. But at the other side, like, that didn't happen when Rosie Sexton fought Jessica Andrade, and that was one of the worst beatings I've seen in the UFC. So it's six of one and half a dozen of another, really.
And if you look at Herb as well, he was in charge, obviously, the Las Vegas fight with Junior Dos Santos and Cain Velasquez when, you know, Cain was destroying him.
Which probably let go on.
And, you know, he let go on. So there's a air of inconsistency. You know, I believe Herb is one of the best in the game, but certain fights definitely over the last year leave a little bit to be desired in his you know, what he's going to do with a fight. It's a bit up in the air, and we saw that again on Saturday night, obviously, with the Mike Pyle TJ Wahlberger fight, as I mentioned. But Ronda Rousey, another dominant win, her first win by TKO. You know,
she predicted it as well, didn't she?
Yeah, I think she did. Yeah, she wanted Edmund Tavardi, and she was speaking to her coach that she wanted to finish it by TKO, mix it up a little bit. But obviously we know Ronda's going to take a little bit time out now. Who's next for Ronda Rousey in the octagon?
I think it just depends on how Catanzaro is mentally and if she's ready to get back in training for a fight. if it's not Katz and Zingano, I think it has to be Alexis Davies.
Yeah, what did you think of that fight? There was a bit of controversy around it. I thought she took a 29-28. A lot of people thought Jessica Eye took it. It was obviously the split decision. What was your opinion on that fight?
I actually thought Jessica Eye took it myself due to the damage. Alexis Davies controlled it in the grappling sense and like fought her game well. She definitely lost the first round, I thought, to Jessica Eye. And then I thought the third was really the throw up, and it just really depends. Like, judging is kind of, the last round is always the big influencer, but Jessica Eye was catching Alexis Davies and hurting her. She's great stand up, which just once again shows that Jessica Eye pushed Alexis Davies, and she's been beaten by Aisling Daly. Yeah. But Alexis Davies beat Rosie Sexton, but Rosie Sexton beat Aisling Daly. Just goes to show that they can all beat whoever on their day.
Exactly.
I think it was unfortunate for Jessica Eye. It would have been nice for her to get the win, considering the controversy that had been surrounding her recently. But if we just go back to the Rousey fight, a lot of people were claiming that the knee actually hit McMahon in her solar plexus, similar to what happened to Tito Ortiz when he got hit in the solar plexus and just went stiff. Yeah. It kind of immobilizes you for a minute. And same with Travis Brown, when he took that knee from Overeem and dropped and then was able to recover. I just think that Herb may have thought the knee was a little bit worse, because Brown's and Ortiz, if I recall, actually landed square in the chest. Like,
I thought it was more of a liver shot.
It did, and that's what I think was what confused Herb, because it was coming in from the side from a clinch. It actually looked like, I thought it could have got one of the bottom ribs, a floating rib, and maybe Herb thought it could have broken her rib, and that's why she dropped down so quickly, and that's why he stopped the fight. That's what I believe, because the referees had no problem letting I don't know if Herb was refereeing the Travis Brown Overeem fight, but that was allowed to go on because he was able to get back up and defend himself, and he knew that it hit him in the center, because it was fairly clear cut that hit Brown in the center point of his chest in the solar plexus, where this one looked like it could have caught a rib, or as you said, a liver, and then that's gonna be more dangerous.
Yeah, definitely great performance from Ronda Rousey all the same, regardless of the sort of controversy around the decision of the fight. But she moves on, and obviously she's going to take a bit of time out now, as you mentioned there, to record some movies, I believe, and she'll be back at the end of the summer.
Late summer, hopefully against Canzingano. But what do you make about all the cyborg stuff?
Yeah, it's interesting. Dana, you know, was asked about it, and, you know, Cyborg's going to have to, you know, fight a few more times. There's obviously a big history with Tito Ortiz and Dana White, who's Cyborg's manager. It'll be interesting to see. I don't think it's going to happen within the next, you know, before the end of the year, but Cyborg says she can drop down to 135 now. I think she's regretting really not staying around in the UFC. Obviously, poorly advised, Dana believes, from Tito Ortiz, who said, I believe, quote-unquote, she would die if she cut to 135 pounds, which is a ridiculous statement. You know, get someone like Mike Dolce on board. We've had Mike on the show here many a time in the past, and Mike was open to working with her, and that, I don't think, materialised. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens, but, you know, I can't see it happening in the next 6 months, Andrew.
Yeah, to be honest, it's she really shot herself in the foot with those comments, because Dana got her actually quite well. She's like, look, you said you're going to die, so why? What's changed now? Yeah. And I don't think there's two sides to an article. Two sides to the argument. I read a great article on Bleacher Report yesterday, and they said why is don't let her fluff about in the independents. Get her in now and make her fight at 135 to prove that she can cut to it. Yeah. With like the stipulation in her contract that if she does miss weight once, that she's cut. That obviously she was just bullshitting and look to be signed. Or do you let her like folly around in Invicta or something like that to try and cut down to 135 and then bring her? I don't think they should waste any time, and they should sign her now, because even if she does prove that she can cut to 135 in Invicta once or twice, when she gets signed for the UFC, she still should not skip the queue and get an automatic title shot. So I think just get her in now and have her cut to 135 in the UFC and fight the girls that are already there, because I don't agree that she should skip the queue, because she may well be the person that could beat Rousey or her biggest test, but Alexis Davies and Canzingano have done enough within the UFC to warrant a UFC title shot before her.
Definitely, but it's not going to happen now, is it, Andrew?
I don't know. Dana says one thing publicly and they're doing another thing privately.
Yeah.
Like, I agree that there was no reason to talk about Gilbert Melendez's contract situation, because in any sport, talking about contract negotiations publicly does not help.
Of course.
Whether it's football, soccer, or football and soccer are the same. Let's say NFL, soccer, anything like that. You never see public negotiations discussed.
Exactly.
As out there as they are in mixed martial arts. So Dana probably knew behind the scenes, even though he was fielding no comments, that Melendez probably was going to sign. Of course he talks to Lorenzo about it. So I'd just say get Cyborg on board. She's obviously going to be tested every week in her camp. The UFC do not want a high-profile steroid case such as Cyborg, especially if they are trying to build her up for title contention. I don't think it would do the UFC any favors at all.
Definitely.
But there's some, like, I'd love to see Cyborg matched up with Holly Holm. I think it might be a little bit too early for Holly Holm, but just in terms of a stand-up match, she should definitely.
It's going to be very interesting, you know, when Holly Holm does eventually, you know, get into the UFC, because I don't think there's anyone in the women's division that's on par, or that is going to be on par with how good her striking is. And it could really test a lot of the ladies in there, including Ronda Rousey, because Ronda's striking, let's be honest, is still pretty wild at times.
Yeah, Ronda's striking, I thought, did look a lot better, though, at the weekend against Sarah McMahon. She's the type of girl that will, she will strike in order to close the distance, and in that, she will maybe take two, but land three, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So and after she connects with the first, her follow-ups are a little bit wild, but we're still connecting with McMahon, and then she was clinching up. So I think, I don't know if she would actually, let's say if she did fight...
Holly Holm.
If she did fight Holm, or if she did fight Cyborg, that wouldn't be a great tactic for her, because those three shots that she may take in order to get into the clinch would be bad for her. Something I'd love to see Ronda Rousey do is shoot for singles and shoot for doubles.
Definitely.
Something I haven't seen. And it's, I think we touched on this before about women's mixed martial arts, about how it's only coming into the prominency in the UFC.
Yeah.
Is that you're going to have a lot more people that are very good at one particular thing, like we said with McMahon's wrestling,
exactly,
and Rousey's judo and Holmes boxing, because they're coming over, where then you had girls like Gina Carano and Cyborg who were just all round mixed martial artists. So I think it's more so the next couple of years than the next 18 months that are going to be the most interesting period for women's mixed martial arts.
Definitely. Just by having this conversation here, it's actually a lot what we talk about later on with Ken Shamrock and Jack Encarnacio, so stay posted for that. We mentioned a lot of the issues that Andrews has brought up there in a couple of those interviews, especially with Jack, about women's mixed martial arts, and he believes it's, you know, the selling point, the future of the UFC. So really interesting stuff there later on in the show. Some other good fights on the card. This fight really bothered me during the week. I think the UFC were really trying to sell this over. It looked as though they put on a bit of a show with the whole Daniel Cormier, Patrick Cummins, the thing on Fox Sports where they were arguing with each other, and, you know, they were really trying to sell the fight, and it just ended the way exactly I thought it would. After 1 minute and 19 seconds of the very first round, Daniel Cormier defeating Patrick Cummins by TKO punches. This is completely the way we thought it would go. Andrew, is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
And it's just, you believe the UFC were putting on, you know, a show trying to sell this fight?
Oh, no doubt. And just, you said something there, a show, and it was something that clicked with me that I meant to bring up earlier. I remember hearing a story about Rousey, about her nickname, Rowdy. She actually asked WWE legend Rowdy Roddy Piper,
that's right, yeah,
if she could use it. And I don't know if you don't strike me as an Instagram user, Niall. As you know, I am a great one due to the selfies that you can post up there.
I am actually an Instagram user, yeah, I am.
Oh, well, then you must follow me. Ronda Rousey, actually has a bit of a click at the minute, and they've dubbed themselves the Four Horsewomen.
Yeah, it's Shayna Baszler.
I think it's Ronda Rousey, Brazler, Shafir, and
Jessamyn Duke,
that are all they're training every day together. They call themselves the Four Horsewomen. They have their picture taken, given the Four Horsemen sign from the old WWF. I think it's they're going to be a strong stable, shall we say?
Like the NWO or something.
Oh, exactly. And I just think that's the interesting side of it, how you like you get to know fighters outside of it. And I really do think a lot more fighters, it's something that CM Punk talked about a lot, and it does link into the co-main event, about how Pat Cummins was selling the fight so much and saying, back in the day, I used to make this guy cry. Like, people are given airtime on Fox Sports 1 or on pay-per-view, or on, like, millions of people could be watching or will watch due to the internet afterwards. And these guys just want to thank their coaches and thank God and thank Jesus. Jesus won't sponsor you. You need to get out there, promote yourself, and get actual, like, these guys get, like, they complain about UFC pay. If you have a gimmick, if you have a character, if you're someone who people want to actually hear from, you'll get sponsors.
You're talking about everything that we talk about with Chaka Encarnacion in a while. It's brilliant. Right. It's brilliant. It's amazing. I can't believe this has all come up, and it's going to lead in quite well.
Same business minds. Anyway, the UFC were building that fight up, and they had no choice but to build it up. You're getting this guy in on 10 days' notice. What are you going to do?
And it sort of at the end of the fight when Cormier was interviewed, it's sort of, you know, he was still trying to sell it like as if he didn't want to say anything to Pat. You know, he goes, oh, you know, he didn't go over shake his hand, still started saying, you know, Pat was talking smack about him, etc. So it came off a little bit corny to me anyway.
Yeah, well, what I personally didn't like was how he mentioned all of the previous training sessions, because anything can happen in training. You know what I mean? Like, I sweep and submit like higher belts in jiu-jitsu and training, but if it came to a tournament when you're actually switched on, there's no way that I'd be able to do it. The same way when Cormier actually wrestled Pat Cummins, he beat him to zero in two matches. So, and then Cummins neglected to inform that he was brought in as a training partner for the Olympic team, which meant it would have been a fresh partner every minute or every 2 minutes. So, like, for all we know, Cummins could have been Cormier's last training partner of an hour and a half long Shark Tank that his coaches are trying to break him mentally. And yeah, you probably are going to cry after that.
Definitely. Daniel Cormier obviously moves on. Good win from, I think he's gone in at number 6 now in the light heavyweight division in the rankings. What's next for Daniel Cormier? Who would you like to see him fight?
To be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if he fought the loser of Jones and Teixeira.
Yeah, I think that'll be a good matchup for him.
Because I think Jones is going to take. They'd love to give him a title shot. Oh,
title shot.
That's that was a shout out to Stephen Lowry and his son, because Stephen Lowry came up to me at Battlezone the other night, and he said, "I was listening to the podcast with my son, and I really like it, but he thinks you swear way too much." So I'll have to tone it down just a little bit. But I definitely do want to give Daniel a title shot. However, not before they get that great rematch with Gustafsson. Assuming Gustafsson does dispatch of Jimmy Manoa, like I'd say the UFC brass are hoping he does, and then I'd say maybe Cormier against either the loser of Gustafsson Manoa. I'm going to backtrack, actually. They're not going to do that, because that's burying Jimmy Manoa two fights in a row. I don't think the UFC may have hope that he will evolve into a better fighter.
Yeah, well, I think another point is they want to sell Cormier a little bit more before putting him in a title fight.
Yeah, like, do you honestly think there's any point in having Daniel Cormier fight the winner of Shogun or Henderson?
No, because Shogun and Henderson aren't getting a title shot anytime soon.
Exactly, and I don't think that Cormier would dispatch of both of them with relative ease. I saw actually something Pat Miletic said during the week, that he thinks Cormier could be the champion at both divisions fairly easily, like even as, say, 130 pounds.
I don't buy into that. I think Kane would destroy, obviously he's not going to fight Daniel Cormier because they're good buddies and they're corner men, but if that fight was to ever happen, I think Kane would have no problems with Daniel Cormier. I think
the only reason he might have a trouble with Cormier is because they would be around a similar weight. Yeah. It's not like a Junior Dos Santos where he'd weigh 265 pounds and Cormier would only be at the lower end of the heavyweight scale. I don't think it would impact it or anything, but
there's plenty of
fights. It's all fantasy, because I don't think they are ever going to
fight. It'll never happen.
And then it was something I saw on Facebook yesterday. Do you know the way we often say oh, these guys should fight anyway. They're being paid to fight.
Yeah.
And then you can't, like, from the outside, like, jiu-jitsu is another thing. I know in jiu-jitsu, you never fight a teammate because it's actually set up that if you both are in the same weight division, in the same tournament, you're set at the opposite side of a bracket before the tournament is even set. So then the only way you'd possibly come against each other is in the final, and you usually just flip a coin or do a rock, paper, scissors to see who wins. Unless it's for money, then it's usually just a very bad a bad pro wrestling match and one person getting the victory at the end of it. Mm. And we always say, oh, but these guys are the best athletes in the world. They should fight each other. Then I thought, do you think Owen Roddy and Conor McGregor would fight?
No.
No. Do you think Cathal Pendred and Gunnar Nelson would fight?
No.
No. And
unless they had a major falling out, but unlikely to happen.
And we know these guys, and they aren't ever going to fight each other. So now that we have a local perspective of two world-class athletes,
you can relate to
not fight each other. You can relate to the fact that Cormier and Velasquez won't fight. And I think that's something that Dana has shot himself in the foot with before, saying, oh, these guys will fight when they see how much money I want to throw at them. Like, fair enough, I know there are guys, and maybe Cahill and Gunny are the two type of people that would be able to put X and Y aside for 15 minutes and may the best man win. We're both going to get paid after it. But unless it's for a world title, unless it's for massive, massive money, I don't, because something like that will always stick in your head. You know, when you're back training, you're like, oh, this guy beat me. You know, this guy is better than me. And I know that you shouldn't have that mentality, but people always will.
Exactly. Definitely. Completely agree. Just before we get to the first interview, we're going to talk a little bit. Obviously, there was some really other good fights on the card. We had Stephen Thompson defeated Robert Whittaker with ease in the first round. Some lovely shots. Putting him down. Mike Pyle obviously defeated TJ Wahlberger in the welterweight division, but both those fights in the welterweight division. But moving on, Rory McDonald defeated Damian Maia, and Maia took the first round, and then Rory came back and dominated rounds two and three for me. Really good performance from Rory McDonald. Is this the Rory McDonald of old, and is this Rory McDonald going to move on and become that title contender in a couple of fights?
I think he's the title contender now, to be honest. I don't think, like, his last fight was, like, we now know with Robbie Lawler, was a title eliminator because Lawler's getting the shot against Hendricks. I think McDonald may have realized that, and I don't know if you saw his call out on Twitter, probably one of the the most unassuming title call outs I've ever seen. It's like, at Dana White, at UFC, I would like to fight the winner of Robbie Lawler and Johnny Hendricks. And I think that all, he says he doesn't want that gimmick, but I think he is playing to that gimmick himself of the American psycho, the Canadian psycho, I should say, that doesn't care. He just wants to fight people. The Rory McDonald that got hammered in the first round, which, to be honest, a draw wouldn't have surprised me because I thought Maia was pretty close to getting a 10-8 in the first round.
That's why I mentioned that during the week. I think it was Keith, who writes on the side first, that possibly could have been a 10-8 or a draw because of the first rounds, because he was so dominant in the first round, Damian Maia.
But if you're going to give that a 10-8, then you're probably going to give McDonald a 10-8 for one, maybe rounds two. I think Maia, actually, the turning point that won the fight for Rory McDonald was in the third round when he did a sort of an overhead butterfly sweep to get Damian Maia off him. And I think, like, Maia, had he have secured that position, probably would have seen out the rest of the round on top, controlling Rory McDonald, and done enough to sneak a 10-9.
Maia looked quite tired compared to what we've seen him. Obviously, we saw him against Jake Shields. You know, he went to five rounds with ease, but he really did seem maybe the poor weight cut or something like that. I'm not sure, but he looked really gassed in the early second round.
I agree, but I do think Damian Maia has suffered with cardio issues before in a lot of fights. Then again, Rory McDonald was landing some very sick leg kicks. Am I saying that right?
Leg kicks
to the stomach.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Leg was making me think that he should have been hitting his leg. He was landing some vicious leg kicks to the stomach that, like, two or three of those can really deplete your gas tank, especially for a guy that has had questionable cardio like Damian Maia. However, like Damian Maia, who's looking a bit of a force at 170, coming back to his old ways, That's a fight he could have won with maybe a slightly bit more, like, a better game plan. Yeah. I was surprised that he was trying to stand with Rory McDonald for so many of the second and third rounds instead of shooting for, like, he did shoot for a lot of takedowns, But Maya has seen, we've seen a lot of great takedowns from Maya in the past when he's closed the distance and gone for the clinch, similar to what Rousey was doing, a lot of great judo from Maya in the past. I'm surprised he didn't go for, like, once he realized, didn't he shoot for something like 19 takedowns?
Yeah, it was a crazy amount.
Started the third round and had only hit one of them.
Yeah.
I thought really he should have then switched up and realized he's not getting that. As soon as Rory had timed his takedowns and timed his sprawl defense, I don't think Maya wasn't going to get him down. That's why he could have mixed it up. Maybe he felt he had no option but to stand with him on the feet. But the Rory McDonald we saw, it was like he was so annoyed by the first round, he just, blood in his nostrils, you know what I mean? Like a shark with blood in the water, he just went in for the kill. Probably will be a little bit annoyed that he didn't get the finish, but his striking just looked superb. He was methodical with his strikes, just 1, 2, 3 and get back out. And he definitely looks like the type. I'd love to see McDonald and Condit go at it again.
That's what I want next. I want him to fight Carlos Condit. I was about to mention that before, you know, the talk of a title shot comes about. I really want to see that fight again. It would be an absolute barn burner. I think Rory's obviously, you know, come on in leaps and bounds since that loss to Carlos, and it would be a fantastic matchup to make.
The only thing is Condit's fighting on the same card.
That's right. He's fighting Woodley. Woodley.
So I'd actually think the loser of that fight, maybe they don't want to give Tyron Woodley a... Okay, let's say, theoretically, Condit wins, then Condit deserves the next title shot because Condit and the new champion will both be fighting on the same card, so they'll both have the same time frame to prepare for the next fight. Whereas then Rory McDonald should fight Tyron Woodley, I think, and I think Woodley would be a good test for McDonald. And stylistically, the type of fight that McDonald could keep standing and maybe get a finish, and then, oh, McDonald's back, two great fights, he's back to the killer, we can sell this as a title fight. So personally, I think it's going to be Condit next, then McDonald, and then we'll see what happens. You never know who could be shooting up the ranks or who even could be the champion. Whoever loses the title fight may get back into contention. It's a great time to be a top-ranked welterweight.
Definitely.
in the UFC, there's no doubt.
Definitely. I think Carlos Condit might actually have problems against Tyron Woodley because he's had problems with wrestlers in the past, so I don't think that's a foregone conclusion, but I would favour Condit, but I think it's a lot closer than a lot of people think. But definitely exciting times to come in the UFC welterweight division. Just another notable performance there from Eric Koch against Rafael Oliveira. Really good performance from Eric, a guy who was number one contender not so long ago on the prelim card, on the fight pass card. A really dominant display. I don't know if you saw that, Andrew, but a cracking performance from Eric Koch.
He moves up to lightweight
as well. Yeah, that's correct.
That's it was Jonah there. It was like the prelim card. From what I saw of it as well, like Zach Mikowski as well, he's kind of making a bit of a claim for himself, maybe to be the next guy to get a shot at 125 pounds now. He beat Scott Jorgensen, beat Josh Sampo at the weekend. I think all he needs is might need a finish or maybe one more fight as a finish, and then, you know, you're going to be throwing him straight into contention. Yeah. The funny thing as well is that people were saying that Pickett would be in contention if he had have won, beat McCall. You have to wonder, like, if Neil Seary does beat Brad Pickett, where does that put him? Because if they're saying that Pickett would have been as good to challenge for Demetrius Johnson's title, I'm not suggesting for a second that Neil Seary gets a title shot as soon as he beats Brad Pickett. But I don't think he'd be too many fights off it if he just came in and that's a big feather in his cap straight away with Brad Pickett.
Yeah, definitely. And you seem quite confident there. You said as soon as he beats Brad Pickett, do you feel Neil is going to beat him?
I'm not saying in that way. I'm not saying, when he beats. I'm just saying it like I was speaking there, continuing on the assumption that he does beat Brad Pickett. Okay. I do think he matches up. I think it's the best possible fight Seary could have coming into that division. He doesn't have to fight a guy with great wrestling, like John Moraga. He was a great wrestler. I think it's just perfect for Seary. It's a fairy tale. It could be a fairy tale couple of months for Neil Seary. That's all I think.
Yeah, it's going to be brilliant. Obviously, that goes down Saturday week in London at the O2 Arena. I believe there's a couple of tickets still remaining, not very many. So if you're not on board, get over to London for the crack. It'll be good fun over there. Okay, before we get to the first interview of the day, obviously you can catch Andrew on Twitter at Andrew McGahan_. You catch me at Niall McGrath 4, and obviously you can hit us on the website talkingbrawlsmma.com and on Twitter at TBMMADOTCOM. So hit us up as always. Subscribe on iTunes. You can now listen to the show actually on TuneIn Radio as well. It's a great little app. If you don't know about it, it's an absolute cracker. So let's get to it with the first interview of the day. And a lot of stuff, Andrew, that we were talking about there, Jack refers to here. So it's a good way to lead in, I think, to the first interview of the day. I caught up with Jack Encarnacio of Sherdog Rewind on w.sherdog.com. Obviously, you know Sherdog if you're a regular on the mixed martial arts scene, a fantastic website. And Jack and myself and Joe Riley, who contributes to the site, we're doing a little thing over the next few weeks. We're going to talk a little bit about the business side of mixed martial arts, so it's really focused on that. So yeah, check that out, and we'll be back to talk about UFC China. So check it out, guys. Thanks.
Hey guys, this is Ian McCall, UFC flyweight, and you're listening to Talking Brawls.
Delighted to welcome back on the show Jack Encarnacio from Sherdog.com, and obviously of the great show on the Sherdog.com radio network, The Rewind. Over the next couple of weeks, myself and Joe Riley, obviously a contributor at the website here on TalkingBrawlsMMA.com, we'll be discussing a number of the elements of the business side of mixed martial arts. Joe, first of all, great to make your debut on Talking Brawls radio here. How are you keeping, my friend?
I'm doing well. Great to be on, man.
Great stuff. And Jack, really do appreciate you taking the time out to join us on the show yet again.
It's my pleasure, guys. Thanks.
Well, Jack, it's good to speak to you. And just as Niall said, this is part of a series that we're doing over the next few weeks where we hope to basically speak with certain personalities in the sport, journalists alike, regarding this issue of, I suppose, where the whole paradigm of the sports and business aspects of MMA meet. So just to kick things off, really, overall, when you look at MMA, obviously you've had with your Rewind segments have been really great. Everybody should check them out. But you've had guys like Meltzer on, Jim Ross, former WWE commentator. So you're very in touch with the entertainment and figures business aspect of the sport. So my first question really to you is, when you look at MMA, do you see it more of a sport or business, or like what is it, like a 50-50 thing or a 60-40 thing? How do you see the sport?
Well, good question. I think 60, maybe 70 in the entertainment side, to tell you the truth, because this thing doesn't work unless it's consumed as entertainment. You can put it here in the States under the Fox Sports banner all you want, but pay-per-view numbers, which is still the key driver of revenue in this industry, don't move unless people are engaged in the personalities the exact same way they'd be engaged in a character on a television show, or a character that compels them to buy a movie ticket, or a story that compels them to buy a movie ticket. So in a lot of ways, if the show isn't entertaining, there really isn't a whole lot of consumer interest in this sport. The numbers that catch the eyes of the people in the television world who make all the difference in terms of how much the sport can grow, those numbers are always drawn by stories, by characters, by personality clashes, and not drawn on the basis of interest in just the pure sport alone. It's just a bunch of characters who can settle it with real fights, and that's very intriguing to people if it's done the right way, and if the story is told on a platform where it can really sink into people. It's just that extra bit where, oh my God, here's a story, and on top of it, these guys are really going to fight to settle it all.
Definitely, Jack. And obviously, we've learned over the last number of months, the UFC have lost their number one pay-per-view guy in Georges St-Pierre. Obviously, we're not sure how long yet. And obviously, Anderson Silva is out for another 11 months at least. You know, is there the characters there? And, you know, is there the storylines there at the moment? And who in the future, you know, might bring these storylines to us to promote the sport on a business level?
It's a great question, because you never know exactly where they're going to come from, and you don't always know, because it changes all the time in the culture, what the right notes are to strike to get people interested. Look no further than Pat Cummins, who faces Daniel Cormier at UFC 170 coming up on Saturday, a guy who truly, absolutely, he was not even close to a blip on the radar a couple of weeks ago. And after getting a platform to show this kind of cocky side to himself, to own the story of the grudge between him and Dan Cormier, to actually bring out of Daniel Cormier, for while a great guy and a very good, eloquent speaker, kind of a flat personality, to bring some rage out of this guy, makes him 10 times more interesting. Those kind of things just happen. It's not so much a matter of mining the world for this talent. It's It's a matter of conditioning yourself as marketers and as promoters to know when to strike, to be able to sniff an opportunity when it presents itself. These things kind of happen organically in a lot of ways. I mean, think about where Ronda Rousey came from. Pretty much out of nowhere, suddenly there was this woman who was racking up first round arm bars on the California area circuit with a judo bronze medal under her belt, who, as soon as they put the camera in front of her and gave her a chance to speak, immediately you knew that she had an ability to communicate and talk about what she was doing in a way that could draw in average people who aren't necessarily vested in the intricacies of this sport. And that's what it takes. Now, the role of a promoter, the role of, you know, someone who's in the business of shepherding along these drawing cards, these potential drawing cards, is to know what to do with that raw material when you have it. And that is an art much more than it is a science. And there aren't that many people on the planet who know exactly how to do it, who know how to ride the wave of momentum that a fighter creates organically. That's why nobody else can do this short of Dana White and a few other people kind of do this successfully and continuously and always have an eye out for the kind of fight style, the kind of way of expressing oneself that moves numbers and puts asses in seats.
Like we discussed on the onset here of this interview, it is a two-sided coin, but maybe a more heavily favored part of that coin is on the business aspect. But obviously with the sporting aspect, another question I'd have for you is that when you look at MMA as a sport, compared to more mainstream sports, if you look over the state side, you've got NFL, NBA. Over this side of the world, Premier League football, like soccer, is the major kind of sporting organization. Do you think MMA as a sport is held back by the current setup of like different promotions? You've got UFC, you've got Bellator. It's not just one entity that basically controls the whole pie, so to speak.
Well, I think those things just happen in the marketplace. It's not really something that anybody wants to do anything about. It's not like Bellator wants to merge with the UFC. I mean, the fact of the matter is the UFC grew here in the United States on the Spike television channel on cable from 2005 when the first season of The Ultimate Fighter hit and everybody got into the sport, or at least the masses got into the sport, and they built their entire reputation and their entire momentum on that platform. And then when the deal came up, Fox came and dangled a bigger carrot and they jumped to Fox, leaving Spike having this pretty significant hole in its scheduling, which had always been UFC programming that drew good numbers. And so now they're in the game. You know, I mean, the economics of television is really what dictates the fact that we're always going to have several bidders out there for your attention and not one centralized sport. If somehow all the television money was there to say, everyone has to get together and we're going to pay this obscene amount of money to everybody, then we might be talking. But I think the way it works now is the way it's always going to work because, you know, it's programming. It's programming. And in the television world, when you're looking for programming, you're looking to compete. You're looking to offer up another version of something that you know already works. That's typically the state of mind, the frame of mind of the television producer. And, that doesn't really align.
Well, I mean, but just in regards to Zuffa as a company, we know anyone who's followed the sport for some time, we know that prior to the Spike era, during the Spike era, post-Spike, and now indeed Fox, we see this incredible journey of what Zuffa has done for the sport, and that can't be denied of how much the Fertittas, Dana White have loved this sport and have done so much of it.
And they really salivated at the thought of working with them and creating the Super Bowl umbrella, and it was a failure. It just didn't happen because there was too much to be lost from a business perspective for one side or the other to come out of that not looking superior, not looking better. And I think, you know, to say that the UFC is the only barrier to having this centralized sport, this unified sport, is to discount the fact that, you know, let's say, for instance, Viacom-owned Bellator would just jump right into bed and do that. I mean, I think they have the best interest of the sport at heart in as much as they're the only people that have been able to make enough money to even reinvest back into the sport to begin with.
Jack, do you see anyone challenging in the next few years? Obviously, you know, the likes of Bellator, this talk of Gail Melendez joining Bellator. Do you see any like the newer promotions such as, you know, I know Titan FC are sort of launching now. Do you see anyone really making a push to challenge the UFC?
No.
Not at all.
Sure, actually.
I could give a very involved answer to that, but I mean, Bellator has resources. As I mentioned, they're owned by one of the biggest media conglomerates in the world, Viacom. But the real reason for that is because after the way it went down with the UFC, where they grew so heartily on a Viacom platform, Viacom said, well, look, we want to still be in the MMA business, but let's make sure that we're getting a piece of the action if some league becomes this huge moneymaker by using our television. And look, it's a two-way street. It's not like Spike didn't get anything out of the UFC's growth. One could argue they got just as much, if not more, in their profile growth out there in the American television landscape. But, you know, I think when it comes down to it, you know, when it comes to challenging the UFC, it's like, it's, you just can't, I mean, you really, for an American corollary, I mean, who's going to challenge the NFL? Who's going to do it? It sounds like a trope, but I mean, it's been tried. It just won't happen. It's sunk in to the consumer in such a way that UFC equals MMA that it's just not. The only thing that could happen is if for some reason there's a huge series of misfortunes for the UFC and they suddenly are out of money and all of their drawing cards are being offered more money by a conglomerate-backed opponent, and they go over there. We saw this. I don't know to what degree you guys, your listeners, might be familiar with pro wrestling, but I always make sure to point this out because back in 1997, the WWF/WWE, which is, you know, the giant of the industry, Vince McMahon's organization, was on the ropes as WCW was growing with a lot of his older stars and more resources, and they were able to pay these guys these guaranteed contracts that were insane, and they brought over all these huge names and drew television ratings and really were sucking a lot of money out of the WWF, and they eventually sort of righted the ship by reimagining themselves and discovering new stars. But short of that happening, where for some reason another competitor can offer triple the money to the guys that, and gals actually now, who move pay-per-view numbers, I don't see it happening. I think the UFC has everything from a contractual and a legal standpoint, even too much on lock for anybody really to make a lot of headway in that direction. And they've got the most money.
You know, very much like what you mentioned, even the history of WWF, then obviously now WWE and WCW, history kind of repeated itself in MMA, where you had obviously the UFC establish itself, Pride comes on the scene, lures a lot of guys away for bigger money, and then UFC ends up, you know, overtaking Pride and ultimately buying them out. But speaking of Pride, though, and pro wrestling, of course, you mentioned, from a business perspective, do you think there are things that the current MMA landscape can glean or learn from the current pro wrestling model that it isn't taking advantage of now in the way it markets itself?
Not so much in the way it markets itself. I don't think it would. You know, first of all, I don't see much of a difference as far as the fights that really move business between the way that a successful MMA fight is marketed and the way a successful pro wrestling match is marketed, putting aside the fact that one has a predetermined outcome and one doesn't. It's pretty much the same elements that get people's attention. Same thing in boxing, as a matter of fact. Strong personalities, an issue that will come to a head, you know, people you want to see lose, people you want to see win, etc. But I think what mixed martial arts and the UFC in particular could learn more from pro wrestling about is getting a better idea of how to identify in a fighter qualities that they can accentuate that will make the general public more interested in them. Just, I think they could use a little bit more refining in terms of sitting down a fighter, and I talked to Jim Ross about this on the Rewind podcast that you mentioned earlier, sitting a fighter down, talking to him, having a producer talk to him who isn't just some fresh-faced, you know, college kid who is willing to work 20 hours a day, and that's why he's got the job. But somebody who really knows and has experience in identifying in people what makes someone a television star, and getting that out of the fighter, and getting fighters comfortable talking about themselves, because, you know, a lot of great fighters are nose to the grindstone types. They were collegiate wrestlers. They were even higher level international caliber wrestlers or other athletes, and those sports don't reward kind of personality. Those sports don't want you to stand out necessarily, or it doesn't put more money in your pocket to do that. It puts more money, or it increases your future chances just to win, just to get the Duke, just to get your hand raised. And when you make that transition into MMA, where you can make double, triple the money, if somehow you can get people interested in your personality and invested in whether you win or lose, it becomes a huge factor. But a lot of these guys aren't equipped to find that in themselves. And in pro wrestling, I mean, they've got
decades, dare I say a century plus of experience, and sitting a guy down and saying, all right, this is what you bring to the table, and this is what it is about you that will hook the general public. I'm not saying you give these guys fake characters, because 90% of the time when you do that in pro wrestling, it doesn't work either. The public doesn't buy these gimmicks that you pull out of the sky. Very rarely, you know, will they create whole cloth, this cartoon-like character that'll sell and last the test of time. But you dig into someone's backstory. Mm-hmm. You know, there's footage out there, some of the documentaries that have been made about pro wrestling, and I remember one called Beyond the Mat from 1997, yeah, where Vince McMahon sits down and you see the process. He's talking. He's getting to know this new talent, and as he's listening, you can tell he's making notes. Okay, this is kind of what it is about you that we can really use to try to make you a star.
Excellent stuff. Completely agree. And you speak a lot there about personalities, Jack. And, you know, the UFC, obviously, since the launch of the women's division, Ronda Rousey and now Miesha Tate, we've so many personalities. And the UFC have obviously announced a new strawweight division with the Ultimate Fighter series coming up very shortly. Do you think, you know, you've personalities like, you know, Felice Herrig, who likes to, you know, promote herself in with a sexual sort of manner. Then you've Beck Rawlings, you've Thug Rose Namajunas. Is the women's divisions in the UFC the way forward to, you know, entice the public into viewing their product?
Yeah, I think that's clearly a new frontier for them. And this is a business where new frontiers don't come along too often. And the ratings for the Ultimate Fighter women's season with Rousey and Tate as coaches indicated that. Higher ratings when the women fought compared to the men. You had both folks on equal playing fields, and people were more interested in the women fighting, and I think that's going to last a while. I think we're looking at maybe another 5, even 10 years before the novelty sort of wears off, and seeing two women go at it in a mixed martial arts fight in the cage, and that's a huge advantage and a great launch point to hook the general public. So I think the future is very, very bright for female fighters who can find their way into the UFC, because opportunities are very ripe right now to catch attention, because for the most part, the idea of the UFC on television does not have a fraction of the cachet that it used to. You know, that was a huge part of the initial boom here in the States, and I'm sure everywhere else in the world, is this idea that this is now on television. And look, this is a real fight with very few parameters, or at least very few apparent parameters, and it was intriguing just on that basis, and that's always easier to make stars when people are looking in from a curiosity standpoint in the first place, and that's what female MMA has right now as it hits this platform of the UFC. So yeah, girls like Felice Herring, girls who really have a command of their personality and have an interest and understand the marketing side of themselves, really have a massive opportunity in the next 5 years, even 10.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if we could just like switch back even to the sports side, and just coming from a question that comes out of that, I think the purest aspect of any MMA fan. Earlier this week on the SRN, I heard TJ DeSantis and Jeff Sherwood talk about the whole Gilbert Melendez offering the title upon that he accepted, which the UFC had an opportunity to match that offer. I heard even TJ and Jeff kind of, stewing over the whole question, is this good for the sport? So what's your take in this kind of situation, this situation with Gil Melendez at the moment? Is it good for the sport, for example, if the UFC just waives the right to match and just lets him go to Bellator?
Yeah, I don't know if it's good for Gil Melendez. This is great for Gil Melendez. Yeah. And what's good for fighters, you could argue is good for the sport. But we've seen in boxing that can get out of hand, too. You know, that if you cater 90% to the financial interests of the athlete as an individual, it gets very, very, very difficult to make matches, to make fights. It almost becomes ridiculously complicated to put a bout together if you don't have some degree of control. But, for the sport, I don't know. I don't think it really makes much of a difference for the popularity of the sport if Gilbert Melendez is pitting Bellator against UFC at the bargaining table. I don't see any impact there. I just think it's better for Gil Melendez, and all the power to him. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who can genuinely argue that these fighters don't deserve to get every penny that they can while they're in their athletic prime, because it is a very short window, and if you fail, it can be catastrophic in terms of you're literally just starting your life over again, because, you know, the MMA, you didn't catch fire in MMA. No matter how good a fighter you were, you just didn't catch fire. And so, you know, you can be in a position where if you don't invest wisely, or if you don't even get enough money to invest any of it, you have nothing to show for it, and you have to start a second life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've heard like Josh Gross, for example, formerly with ESPN, I heard him say somewhere, I think it was on his podcast, that here's a guy that he maybe doesn't focus so much on the entertainment and number side of it as maybe someone like yourself or Dave Meltzer, but I've heard it mentioned that looking at the dynamic that the sport currently is in with all these different promotions, the question being, is there really such thing as a bona fide MMA world champion? I know, obviously, in any given division at the moment, UFC is the main player. We don't dispute that. But when you have guys like Eddie Alvarez locked up in Bellator, you know, Gil Menendez possibly leaving to go to Bellator, does that really, you know, take away the legitimacy of calling someone a world champion in any given division?
I suppose it does. If there's somebody out there who, you know, can make a legitimate claim to being just as good as the other guy's champ, I think that's just a reality of the market. I don't think, you know, if there's anybody looking to make a serious bid in MMA, you're not going to, unless there's some novel business plan on the table, you're not going to settle for guys who you can't argue are just as good, if not better, than the UFC's guys. And so if that's part of your plan, you're always going to be dangling money for guys who are top 10 or top 5 trying to lay claim to them. I don't really see a time when that totally goes away unless the UFC, you know, just continues buying everybody. And they've done that. I mean, it's been pretty remarkable the amount of competition they've bought up. At this point, Bellator being backed by Viacom, who knows? Maybe at some point Viacom says, you know what, this isn't drawing the numbers we wanted. We're not interested in being in sports anymore in this way. UFC, what are you willing to give us for it? I mean, stranger things have happened. But I think, you know, until it does and until for some whatever reason nobody is interested in making a bid anymore to be in this sport, there are going to be those guys who can play the competition against the UFC and get better deals so that that competitor can say, look at this guy we've got, and he's just as good as the other guys over there. It's one of the things, when the UFC rolled out its rankings last year, it struck me, because all the rankings on the internet put everybody together. They put a UFC guy next to a Pride guy, next to a Bellator guy, for example, and UFC's rankings don't do that. And so it always struck me that Sherdog's rankings, for example, which are generally considered kind of the authoritative ones in the sport, they put people on the radar. You know, if you're fighting in an organization that doesn't have a lot of television penetration in the States, but suddenly your name pops up next to some of the best UFC fighters in your division on Sherdog, that's a huge thing for your marketability, and UFC is kind of forced to try to make a play for you. They bring out their own rankings, and they immediately drop people off if they release them, even if they belong in the top 10.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think on that note, that's a very good point. But obviously, that brings up a real relevant reality when we look at, we talked about the strawweight division, the women's division. We have the issue, obviously, where WSOF crowned their inaugural champion, which, you know, you talk to people that are in the know with the WMMA scene, UFC won't have the number one 115-pounder.
Right.
Do you think the UFC are really going to go after to get him on a roster?
Jessica Aguilar, yeah. They probably will. I mean, for Aguilar, it's probably a situation where you've got a promotion that wants to make an impact. It feels like it can get, you know, who's generally considered the best fighter in the division and pays him or her more than the UFC would be willing to pay at face value with no real idea, you know, what the return on investment is. I mean, like I said, there's always going to be those figures in the top five of any division and any gender who are going to be able to kind of catch the ear of someone looking to make an impact outside of the UFC, a competitor, because it just instantly adds to the credibility of your organization. If you can say our champ can beat any of the UFC's and is ranked above the UFC's fighters. So, you know, will they make a play? Probably eventually, but I think the UFC is content, and it's done them well in the past, to just kind of sit back, you know, let fighters who can command those kind of paydays in the moment get them, and then at some point, they're going to probably want to be in the UFC. At some point, you know, that's what they did with Ronda. They kind of sat back with Ronda under the Strikeforce banner. Of course, they eventually bought Strikeforce, but they kind of sat back, and they saw Ronda not only win and be an impressively a fantastic fighter to watch, just a very spectator friendly, and they saw the television numbers move on Showtime, and they said, okay, now's the time to make our bid. But I don't think the UFC's ever been above this idea of letting someone establish their upside outside of their ranks and then make the play. You know, it's kind of like, let you figure out if anyone really cares about Jessica Aguilar beyond people who, you know, scrape deep enough into the internet to find women's strawweight rankings.
Yeah, definitely. And just before we wrap, obviously the UFC this year, you know, it's been a tough start to the year because of, you know, losing GSP and Anderson Silva's injury. And the introduction of Fight Pass, something we haven't talked about. Is the year really for the UFC, you know, solidify basically for the year is what I'm trying to say, I beg your pardon.
Yeah, I think here's the equation. They get about $100 million from Fox. That's the television deal. And that's a game changer because they're not they don't have to make 75% of their revenue like they used to on pay-per-view. It's more around – it's hard to say because they don't disclose their finances, but they do there are reviews of their debt and their bond indebtedness, and you can get a flavor that it's about 55% pay-per-view revenue now compared to 45%. And look, that's the dream. That's how television works. That's how sports work in the television world. If you can convince a television network that it's worth paying the UFC more than they would make if they sold these shows on pay-per-view, then we're like every other sport. Then suddenly this money's guaranteed no matter what they do, and it doesn't really matter if you can necessarily build stars to move pay-per-view numbers because, you know, that's not a consideration, just like it isn't necessarily a consideration in the other sports. Certainly stars will be built, but they sort of do that independently with the backing of sponsors. It isn't the imperative of the league to build stars. It happens. So here we are with about $100 million coming in from Fox. So about 55% they need to make up on pay-per-view. So that's looking, I don't know, it's going to be an interesting year in that way without GSP because he can just make your whole year. Yeah, but if Anderson comes back, we're talking business. Ronda, if she fights three times this year, which the UFC and Ronda said they want to do, that would be business. And look, Fight Pass is what Lorenzo Fertitta says it is. He wants to be successful internationally. He can't do that if he's on at 3 a.m. in the UK. So if he's going to move fights in the UK onto primetime or in Asia or anywhere else in the globe, he's got to make those available to stateside fans, but no television network is going to want to carry MMA at 6 in the morning in the States. And even if they do, what's the point? But if we can get people to sort of pay $10 a month for the privilege, they're not going to be mad because they'll still be able to see the fights through our digital Fight Pass service. And for the future, we'll be conditioning them to get used to watching live MMA on the internet, which is really the pot at the end of the rainbow. Because if they can cut out the pay-per-view providers who take 50% of every pay-per-view buy in terms of the revenue split, that's the cash windfall if they can get there. And so they're laying the infrastructure for that now, but that's the revenue picture in 2014 is, you know, you keep Fox happy, you collect your $100 million, you get some pay-per-view numbers, you know, you do four or five big pay-per-views this year and the Fight Pass revenue is new money.
Just one final question. You mentioned, obviously, you know, who's going to step to the forefront this year. Who, in your opinion, Jack, is going to be the marketable stars that are going to, you know, sell pay-per-views this year? Or who can we expect to step up onto that pay-per-view level? I know Guilherme Cruz from MMAfighting.com possibly mentioned Vitor Belfort if he wins against Chris Weidman because he's so popular in Brazil. Can he go to the level, or is it someone like Conor McGregor? Who are we expecting to come to the forefront and be the real stars of 2014?
I think Vitor is already there, and I don't see him really swelling beyond that because Vitor is one of those guys who still harkens back to the initial UFC boom period of the mid to late 1990s when this sport was doing just ridiculous numbers for a sport with no television platform to promote, no free television advertising, and still hundreds of thousands of people were buying this thing at a time when, you know, a fraction of the homes in the United States even had access to pay-per-view compared to now. So Vitor has that cachet. He beat up on Tank Abbott back when everybody was interested in Tank Abbott back at, UFC 12, and ever since then, Vitor Belfort has been a guy that people in general, if they've ever even heard of the UFC, kind of know, and he did about 700,000 buys when he fought Anderson Silva at UFC 126 at a time when Silva really wasn't a big draw. I mean, he didn't really become a big draw until he fought Chael Sonnen and that sort of, you know, side of his personality was brought out. So I think Vitor, if he beats Chris Weidman, I don't think in Brazil he'll be huge. He's already huge, but they don't have pay-per-view in Brazil, so that's not really the question. Yeah. I think he'll be about where he's at. Who will emerge this year? This is John Jones's year to do it because he is obviously a one-of-a-kind athlete, is a fantastic fighter, and by all accounts should reign as champ all year, though he'll have tough challenges. If he can do something that just boggles the mind, if he can go up to heavyweight, or if he can do something truly, truly like, oh my God, he's going for this and pull it off, he could be the draw. This could be his year to break through because right now his numbers are kind of flat. They hover south of 500,000 unless he gets a good grudge going like the Rashad fight did 700,000. So this could be Jones here establish himself. Who brand new? It's really hard to say. I think there's a lot of money to be made on a Hispanic superstar in the United States if they can find somebody. Kane has kind of been that guy, but he's not fluent in Spanish. Yeah, and he has zero personality. I mean, zero. You know, which is fine, but you know, it limits you.
Do you see Conor McGregor possibly by the end of the year, if you know the hype is to be believed, becoming a pay per view star? Yes. There's a lot of talk of him potentially, if he stays injury free and gets the W's, that he might be you know, on a December card in the pay per view fighting for a title in the UFC.
he could do it. I was in Boston in August when he fought and had his knee injury and everything, but I watched the Conor McGregor show all week, all fight week, you know, from the press conference to the post-fight press conference to the way he carried himself in interviews. This guy has it. And if the platform is right, if they can get him on a show where everybody's looking in, people who don't necessarily check out every last minute of UFC fights, and he has a phenomenal performance and cuts a killer interview and gets a grudge going with a fighter who people care about, like, you know, I'm thinking of like Conor McGregor versus BJ Penn, for example. That could put McGregor over the top, something like that. So he's got it. You know, like I said, it's about capitalizing on guys who have it, and he's got it. So we'll see what happens in 2014, but the potential is certainly there.
Brilliant. Absolute pleasure talking to you, Jack. I really do appreciate you coming back on the show. And guys, you can obviously find Jack on the Sherdog Rewind show on Sherdog.com. And Jack, what's your Twitter handle so the guys can hit you up?
Sure, it's at Sherdog Rewind.
Jack, I really do appreciate the time. One of the best in the business, in my opinion, and great having you back on the show. Really do appreciate it.
Hey, guys, thanks so much.
And that was Jack Encarnacio of Sherdog.com, and obviously his show on Sunday nights, I think it is, Sherdog Rewind, a great show. And big thanks again to Jack for his time yet again coming on the show. Absolute top man, one of the best in the business, no pun intended there. Andrew, let's move on a little bit. UFC China this weekend, you know, the Ultimate Fighter finale in China. Obviously, there's a lot we haven't seen. I haven't seen any of the series here. You know, it seems to be a real thrown together sort of product for the UFC in China. Is that a fair comment to say?
They're fairly, shall we say, they really do want to get into that market. I know they've been back in Macau now. I think this might be their second or third time back there. Yeah. I did sign up for Fight Pass, so I am going to watch the season because I heard there's some hilarious fights on it.
Yeah, I heard that. Do we have to pay for to watch the actual series?
Well, it's past the free trial. Oh, the free trial ends tomorrow on Fight Pass. So from tomorrow you will have, or from
no. But when you log on, when you log on to Fight Pass, do you not have to pay for to watch certain series, The Ultimate Fighter? Because I know you have to pay to watch the Canadian, the Smasher series this season.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was just thought it was covered. I did the first thing I watched on Fight Pass was a tough couple of episodes of Hughes and Sarah.
Yeah.
The Ultimate Fighter, and I was enjoying it. Just looking through Fight Pass, it does seem like it's going to be good, but it all depends on how quick they can get stuff up. And
yeah, they need more content.
They need a lot more content.
But yeah, and I'll give it a few months, I think, anyway, because obviously it's a new enough product. But yeah, there's a few interesting fights on this card. One that sort of stands out to me is Nam Phan versus Von Lee. It's sort of an interesting fight in the bantamweight division. Obviously, Nam's coming off I think it's three or four losses now, two losses, three of his last four. Von Lee, we haven't seen Von in quite some time. Is this Von's first fight in, when did he last fight? June of 2013 against Rafael Assuncao, lost that. Interesting fight. It's one of the more sort of high-profile fights in this card. Are you looking forward to this card at all, Andrew?
And even then, Von Lee, before that, fought London last year when we were there, and yeah. I thought he got a very lucky decision in that fight as well, so...
The night of decisions. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. You know,
like I'm looking forward to watching, like with all cards, you know what I mean? It's not a card that I don't have to stay up late for. That's going to be on, well, unfortunately, I won't be able to watch it even on BT Sport and tape delay because of Cage Warriors. But yeah. It is, I'd say that card will be on Fight Pass fairly soon. You can just watch it at leisure. I'm looking forward to seeing Hatu Hayoki against Ivan Menjivar. Considering Menjivar fought St. Pierre years ago at welterweight and now he's fighting at featherweight. Is crazy, but Nam Phan is just. Is this? You said he's lost a few, but is this? How long has he been at bantamweight? I'm just trying to think.
This is his second or third fight. Second fight at bantamweight, possibly.
And he lost against Takei Mizugaki.
Yeah, Mizugaki. Yeah, that's his.
So it'd be interesting to see if he's more adjusted down at bantamweight.
I reached out to him this week, try and get on to him. We've had him on the show a couple of times before. Couldn't get back to him, but obviously it's awkward. But I think a lot of the guys went out to China, sort of Monday or Tuesday this week.
Yeah, like he's a guy whose career is littered with losses. He's 18-12. Yeah. He's always going to be like he stepped in for the UFC late. I think it was in a couple of fights.
Yeah, it's a couple of fights.
And he's got great judo. That's the one thing I'll always say about Nam Phan. No matter what about him being like a so-and-so fighter, I always look forward to seeing him because like he has a good victory over Cole Miller. That's one thing I do remember about his career. And I thought he was actually going to beat Jimmy Hedges until like found out Jimmy Hedges was also a beast at judo, so it didn't really make a difference. It didn't matter from at all. Matt Mitrione, I don't know if he's been punished a little bit by the UFC for his comments last year, being made to fight in in China.
But he's coming off, you know, you tend to forget he's coming off a loss, obviously, against Brandon Schaub as well, which, you know, obviously we know those guys had a bit of a falling out, you know, in the lead up to that fight, but it was quite a dominant performance from Brandon Schaub. And I think Mitrione, you know, I think people are sort of fanning him out. He's a little bit one-dimensional, if it's fair to say.
Well, yeah, okay. You said it, so
that's it.
I'll allow you to say that, but I do think the main talking point on the card should be the return of John Hathaway.
Yeah, definitely.
And hasn't fought since September.
18 months.
Yeah, September 2012. And something kind of funny that the guy who he beat, John McGuire, is fighting in Dublin.
That's right.
So it just shows how two careers have taken two completely different paths. Like, John Hathaway is the UFC's guide, you know what I mean? Like, a decision loss to Mike Pyle, I think that was in London. And beat Tom Egan in his UFC debut, his only UFC finish. But, like, beating Rick Story, who was being touted at the time
Diego
by the UFC.
Sanchez.
Great guy. He's beaten a lot of top guys, and I am really looking forward to his return. The fact that Don Hyun Kim has... He's been around forever, and I'll admit I lost money on him against Eric Silva when he KO'd Eric Silva, like the same guy who hadn't won by a fucking KO since something like 2008, just goes out and KO's Eric Silva within two rounds or something like that. I was so annoyed that night.
It was a very lucky shot against Eric Silva, but it took his head off.
Devastating, and it was...
But where can you see this fight going? Do you think, you know, Hathaway's obviously going to have that ring rust factor. It's going to be tough for him. Is it a little bit unfair, the UFC, to throw a guy like John Hathaway, who hasn't fought in 18 months, to an opponent who, you know, let's be honest, at one stage he was being, you know, touted as a possible title contender in the division.
He's only lost to the elite in the division, really.
Exactly. He seems like a gatekeeper. Do you think the UFC possibly might have, you know, put John on, say, you know, the London card sort of halfway down? Would that not have made more sense?
I think it's a very good fight for Hathaway. I think it's one that he can actually win coming back from a layoff. And then if he does win, you know, he's headlining this card, he can turn around and be like, look, I've been out for so long and I still fucked up your guide. You know what I mean? Your gatekeeper. Now start giving me top tens. Do you know what I mean? To be honest, a fight that I am predicting to be made is John Hathaway versus Gunnar Nelson. I think if Hathaway wins and Nelson wins, then I think the two of them guys match up perfectly. If not, I think we could see the Gunnar Nelson Mike Pyle match that was scrapped. I think that could be matched up yet again.
That will be in the States as well. I think they're gonna if Gunnar wins next weekend, I presume they're gonna, you know, bring Gunnar over to the States, and because he's at that level now. Obviously, the Mike Pyle fight was supposed to be in the States. So, do you see Gunnar making the transition over to America after this?
Yeah, I do. Unless there's a Scandinavian card later in the year that they may want him to co-main or be in the top three of the main event.
Yeah, there's talk of not actually being in Stockholm this year if they go to Sweden. It's going to be in Malmo. That's the word.
Perfect
on the street.
For Ryanair users. Yeah. did we fly into Malmo last year? I can't remember, but I know
we're in Stockholm, I think.
It was the Ryanair Stockholm airport, which is conveniently an hour and a half actually outside of Stockholm.
I think Malmo is way north. I think it's up.
It'd be like flying into Dublin, but flying into Dundalk and then driving an hour and a half to get into the centre of Dublin. That's what it was like in Stockholm. But it was, I don't know, I'd be looking forward to a Scandinavian card again later in the year. I think Gunnar could be high up on that. Definitely. If not, like, maybe just John Kavanagh, when he's over there, might have a word. He's like, look, I'm going to be cornering a couple of guys in the UFC now. You want to do me a bit, save me a bit of hassle, and let's get maybe two or three of them on the one card, so I'm not traveling as much. Not that he'd have any complaint with traveling around to loads of different places and cornering guys, but it's I can't imagine Gunnar Nelson enjoying going to somewhere like Macau in China and having to travel all over there, all the inconvenience of it.
He wouldn't get a sheep head over there to eat. What he probably would actually in China, you get anything you want to eat over there. okay. Ultimately, who do you see taking this fight, Donghyun Kim or John the Hitman Hathaway?
I'm going to go out and say Hathaway is going to take it. And I believe, have we not got a?
Yeah, we do.
Did you tally that up?
No, I have to. I think I won, to be honest, Jim.
All right.
But I'll have to have a listen back and check it just to make sure. I'll go over it. But yeah, you're going with Hathaway. Go on.
I'm going with Hathaway. I think he's going to win by decision.
Okay. I'm actually going to go the opposite. I think Donghyun Kim is going to take this. I think, you know, he might try and get John to the deck and out grapple him. It's going to be an interesting fight, but I'm going to go Donghyun Kim by decision. So yeah, there we go. Well, there we have it. So vice versa. Any other fights? We've mentioned Hatsuyoki, Ivan Menjivar, Matt Mitrione, Sean Jordan. Any other fights that sort of stick out in your mind? Namfan, Vaughn Lee, Norman Parks' former opponent, and Tasuki Tokodome is fighting Yu Chu Yam. I don't know any of these guys. I don't think we're going to bother talking about that because there's a lot of guys we just don't know on the card. Not because our fault, because the UFC did an Ultimate Fighter China. So
have to follow up on that. I like the sound of Cy Wang. I think he's going to beat Li Peng Zhang.
One of the fights, the featherweight Ultimate Fighter finale, was actually pulled from it due to injury during the week. One of the guys
was
injured.
Which was then claimed as well by. I saw that it was the. Someone's claiming that it's actually not an injury, that the guy's just afraid of fighting and he was only doing it to boost his opinion in, what is it, John Pang and Ganyu. That's like, it means nothing to me, but I remember like websites running loads of things saying that, oh, this guy has a history of pulling out of fights in China and in Japan, and it's like he's only doing it to kind of raise his profile a little bit more. Apparently he has no intention of fighting. So I don't know. See how that happens. Like the week of a fight, to pull out one of the main events. That's a bit of a kick in the stones.
One of these guys in the welterweight fight is absolutely. I'm not sure if it's Sa Wang or Li Peng Zhang, and one of them's supposed to be an absolute killer. Apparently,
well, we'll probably know by Saturday.
We'll know by Saturday afternoon.
It's one-sided.
It's live in Fight Pass anyway. I think it kicks off here at 12:45. I think PM.
And even then, I won't be able to see it because I'm competing on. A long day on Saturday. There's Grapplepalooza on in Dublin, and then just I think I'm going to meet up with Brad Wharton and Dem from Cage Warriors, get a bit of lunch, and then head back over to the Helix.
Yeah,
Cage Warriors that night.
Yeah, we'll both be there at the Helix on Saturday night. And on that point, let's talk a little bit about the card on Saturday night. Obviously, we have. Really stacked card, a lot of Irish fighters on the card. But John McGuire against Saul Rogers is the headliner. And then we've, you know, the likes of Artem Lobov, Damian Rooney, Redzer, Philip Mulpeter, Catherine Costigan. There's a huge Irish influence on the card. How much are you looking forward to this Cage Warriors card? It's probably their best of the year so far.
Well, it's only their second, so it's a guarantee to be the best because the last card wasn't too great. But yeah. I think... Cage Warriors are coming back to Dublin, a three-month turnaround. To be honest, it's not because of demand, in my opinion. I know that Cage Warriors have they signed a new deal towards the end of last year to get more events, and it was to promote more events. So I think they're just going through the motions that like they have three events in March.
Yeah. That's right, the fight night in Jordan in a couple of weeks' time, I think, as well.
And then heading to Denmark.
Denmark, yeah.
So Cage Warriors are really, really pushing this European expansion. A couple of fights that I'm really looking forward to. And that, like, Philip Mulpeter must be kicking off the main card. If he had have beat John McGuire, which I did think he did, he, in theory, could be main eventing against Saul Rogers. No doubt Artem Lobov is probably going to offer to fight Saul Rogers after the main event, regardless, because he's chomping at the bit. And to be honest, if Artem wins and Saul loses, I think Cage Warriors could match them up together. That's not looking past Alex Enlund, because that's going to be a tough fight for Artem Lobov. Benny Alloway recently had his run in the UFC, is fighting Jack Mason. Jack is on course to become the fighter with the most appearances ever in Cage Warriors. I think Dan Hardy holds it for 14, and Jack Mason, I think I saw Paul Dollery tweet before, is on 12.
He fights Jack Mason, 5 times a year.
He had a very busy year last year. Going further than the card, nice to see Merv Mulholland back in action. the IFS guys, just from stuff that I've heard, they have a bit of a, they're 100% and they're very nice guys, but they get a lot of stick from other fighters claiming that they're protected in their matchups and stuff like that. Yeah. But Cage Warriors obviously wouldn't pander to anything like that. So Mervyn Mulholland will be in for a tough match.
Do you think, especially for the Irish guys, you look at, you know, Paul Redmond, and you've obviously Artem Lobov, and you know Philip Mulpeter. Obviously, with the, you know, how big the sport is getting here in this country, and you know, especially for guys like Redzer, and obviously we've talked to Artem here a couple of weeks ago on the show, and you know he's been in contact with Sean Shelby, obviously over in Sweden that time, and Sean, so get your record a little bit better, and we'll sign you up. Artem is just crazy to get fights at the moment. Do you think other guys are possibly looking at that Dublin card and thinking, you know, we might have a slight chance of getting on it?
I do, and I know Damien Rooney was looking at it as well, because Damien's making his way down to flyweight.
Yeah.
Damien is he'd be a very close training partner of mine up in Team Towers in Newry, and he's looking absolutely ridiculous for this fight. The weight is coming off him so easy. He's getting all his meals cooked for him by a local cafe that are sponsoring him. And I think Damien actually wouldn't be beyond... Oh, wait, I don't know if Cage Warriors have matched up someone for the flyweight title. And I think the only reason that he won't get a title shot off a win against Brian Creighton is because it's at a catch weight of 130 pounds. As Damien's making his way down to 125. I think he's going to have to make 125. Maybe in June. You see, Damien has a bit of a... He's fought three times in the last 3 years because he also has a personal training business.
He's a stake to get the fights in.
Stake in the gym. He's getting married later on this year. He's building a house later on this year. So actually, I do think if Damien does look well, it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility that he fights again in Dublin in June, assuming the card is early June, as it usually isn't in the Helix as well with Cage Warriors. Then I would think... Damien could fight then, but any later in the summer, I think it may be New Year's Eve or something like that before we see Damien again.
Yeah.
And he was looking towards the Dublin card, but as he said to Petey during the week, he says it may just be a bridge too far. And if it is true that the UFC are planning to be coming back to Dublin maybe every 18 months or every year with this get, like this event will be on at this time every year, then it's like guys may bust themselves trying to get those wins now, thinking that this is the be all end all, but they really don't have to, because if the UFC are going to come back as often as they say they are, they have a lot of time, especially guys like Paul Redmond.
Definitely, completely agree. And another thing with Cage Warriors, obviously in the last 2 weeks, you know, three of their champions have relinquished their belts. You know, it's a real sort of transition period for Cage Warriors. I mean, I know they sort of promote themselves as, you know, sort of a feeder organization to the UFC. How many of these title situations do you see being resolved in the coming months? Obviously, we know Pendred's belt is going to be
contested in Denmark.
Denmark, yeah.
I do think that there's going to be a fairly quick turnaround. I wouldn't be surprised if the lightweight one was sorted soon enough. You don't have to worry about them matching great title fights because Ian Dean is the best matchmaker in Europe by a country mile. And as something Paul Dollery actually tweeted yesterday, he said, oh, Cage Warriors losing three champions, that's going to hurt us, is it? Well, we only have hundreds of the best in Europe to pick from. And with Jim Ehlers as well, it was
big congratulations to Jim. We've had Jim on the show here many a time in the past. So big congrats to Jim on his contract also.
As I said, he's one of the nicest guys I've ever interviewed. One of the only guys as well that has ever said us after I interviewed him, because he has a big influence in BJJ. He's a brown belt. He competes regularly in American super fights and in tournaments grappling. Yeah. For a guy that was kicked out of his camp a couple of weeks before fought. Yeah. Like that's Lions. He really, really deserves this fight. I believe he's fighting in Abu Dhabi. That's something. Jesus, I wouldn't mind going to Abu Dhabi in April. Although I am DJing a 21st that night, unfortunately, Niall. So unless the UFC changed that event.
What are you playing? A bit of One Direction?
Just
a bit of Justin Bieber? All that sort of
No. We'll see on the night. You know, I never plan too far ahead at these sort of things. And apart from that, like, great to see Catherine Costigan, who had such trouble getting fights and being matched up. Two fights in the space of 3 months. Cage Warriors is a great home for her. especially when they're going to just keep churning out. And as I said, Ian Dean will keep finding her fights.
Catherine's a real prospect, isn't she? I know she trains closely with Rosie Sexton. She's good friends with Rosie. She trains with her quite a bit.
Rosie is her coach as well, or manager, I think.
How good is it, or how much potential has Catherine got?
Catherine said something interesting to me, that 115 isn't on her radar in the UFC. She hopes that she's going to make such a name for herself that the UFC will make a 105 division for her. And something like that just kind of stuck out in my head. Catherine has a big kickboxing background. She's very good stand-up. And it's just kind of a gradual process, I said before, of getting the whole game to come together. I know she trained at a Pancration Kickboxing Academy in Limerick, but she's also closely working now with Rush Fight Academy, with Paul Couser, who's also celebrating another one of his amateur fighters turning pro on the card, Neil Ward versus Gavin Kelly, the first fight of the night. It's not the first fight of the night, actually, because Chris Bujard pulled out yesterday. Okay, the first pro fight of the night. It's an unaired prelim starting at 7, I think it is. I know the doors open at 6:15, so there'll be a couple of prelims anyway to keep us, a couple of amateur fights to keep us tied over. But Neil Ward is a guy that I was talking to him last week afterwards in Battlezone before I interviewed Thomas Hogan, and Neil's really looking forward to it. He says weight's coming down lovely. It shouldn't be any sort of problem. He's just excited to finally get in there. He said it was a mixture of both. The fact that he's making his pro debut on a show like Cage Warriors means a lot to him, because he's seen a lot of people make pro debuts on other, like, as I said before, Battlezone in halls and stuff like that. He knows he's going about it the right way, but there was a bit of, you know, I asked him, you know, you've lost a teammate, John Redmond. He's like, it's not going to affect me in the slightest. I have full faith in my coach. I have full faith in my teammates, you know what I mean? And Kaiser then said to me as well, I know it as well because I followed their team quite closely in the last year, their amateur scene. They have guys like Adam Caffrey, who won Cage Warriors on New Year's Eve as an amateur, who is ready to turn pro. It's just his age. He's only 20. Then his younger brother, Luke Caffrey, who's an absolute phenom. And I say this now for you to be able to dig it out in 2.5 years, will be in the UFC, will be a great pro. He takes to any sort of martial art, anything that he's taught, he takes to like a fish to absolute water. He's been boxing in national championships. He doesn't know if he is going to focus on MMA or he is going to focus on boxing, because he's taken to both of them. Yeah. Just like I said, without using that expression again, like a fish to water, a flight to shit, whatever, like me to a camera, whatever you want to say.
That's it. He's Andrew to Snapchat.
To a front-facing camera selfie. It's
you got
to
stop them, man. They're driving me mental. I'm
joking. Hater. And giving me shit about my Skype profile picture as well.
Rid of it. I'm going to post a picture of that on Twitter.
Swear no, to God, dude. It's brutal. It's great. And it's like, I don't know, you're looking at, like, I'm just looking at the Cage Warriors website now. The Cage Warriors bout, like, the thing that you're going to notice as well is that they are so rigorous. And the main card will start at 9, and it will start at 9 on the button, because
MMAJunkie.com.
It's going live on MMA Junkie for the USA and Canada, IrishMMA.tv for Ireland only, Viaplay for Scandinavia, CageWarriors.tv for the rest of the world. It's going to be live on Premier Sports, live on Setanta Sports 1 in Ireland, free to air, Fight Now TV in the US, the Fight Now in Canada, Belgium, Portugal, Turkey and the Middle East, Fight Club in Poland, TV3 Sport and Sport 2 in Denmark, Setanta Action in Africa, and ESPN in Oceania and the Caribbean. I'm sure there'll be many from the Caribbean tuning in to see the white Irish fighters descend upon the Helix on Saturday night. Dude. But it just shows that these guys have a big, big reach and a big exposure. And if you want to get your name out there, if you want to be seen as one of the best in the game, you need to get fighting on Cage Warriors ASAP.
Definitely. The guys at Cage Warriors doing an absolutely cracking job. Graham Boyle and Ian Dean and Paul Dollery and the whole crew, they're absolutely fantastic stuff. And really looking forward to being along there at the Helix this Saturday. And if you haven't got your tickets, I believe there's still one or two left, so you can hit up cagewarriors.com and you can just check out the details there and get your tickets if you haven't already bought them. Really can't wait for it. Really looking forward to see Reds or Ben Holloway. Jack Mason is going to be an interesting fight as well. Obviously, Artem Alex Englund, because of the whole Twitter slating, that bashing war rants that Artem has been on lately. It's been really entertaining. So there's some really good fights on the card. So get along, as I said, if you haven't already. How much are you looking forward to, Andy?
Oh, the Cage Warriors is... There's one thing I hate about Cage Warriors, and it's how organized they are, because it is very, very tough, especially where they have their little press area, is that you can't, I like me and Graham personally, we can't even sit like the rest of you fucks and just enjoy it, because we are sprinting upstairs, downstairs, through emergency exits to catch a fighter in the hallway before he gets his medical, so we can grab a quick interview, video interview, and then be out just as the first round is maybe starting or is already a minute into it. Really is a very well-run show. A nightmare for us to get the interviews right afterwards, but I suppose if I'm going to complain about having work to do, then I may complain about that tomorrow's being Friday, because it's better to have work than not have work.
Definitely. Completely agree. Well said, Andrew. Great stuff there, you freak. but okay, let's get to the next interview of the day. I caught up with the one and only, the legend that is, Mr. Ken Shamrock. And, you know, we talk about all sorts of things. So from Frank to Dana White to steroids to, you know, UFC fighter pay, all the work. So listen, myself and Andrew back in a few minutes to sum up the week's news, some newly announced fights.
Hi, this is UFC lightweight TJ Grant, and you're listening to Talking Brawls.
Absolutely privileged to be on a Talking Brawls MMA show. The one and only former King of Pancras, former UFC champion, current UFC Hall of Famer, Ken Shamrock. Ken, first of all, mate, I'd like to wish you a happy belated birthday. How are you keeping? How are things with you?
Oh, I'm doing good, man. Loving life one day at a time.
Could you just explain to the guys what was it like in the early days under, you know, Bob Shamrock in the boys' house there, and what life was like?
Well, it was, I mean, like I said, I filled a lot of homes growing up. At 10 years old, I was in juvenile hall, living out of a car, got stabbed, ended up getting put into place and becoming a ward of the court. And I went through several different places and failed a lot of them, just getting in trouble, fighting and in trouble. And then I landed at a place called the Shamrock Boys Home in Susanville, California. And it was just different. It was the love that he showed to the boys there, and the structure that they had in the house. It wasn't like a number or a piece of meat. We were all individuals and human beings, and he cared for us as such. And so because of that, I was able to turn my life around because of his help and guiding me and helped me use the frustration into something positive, which at the time was sports.
Mm, exactly. And how did you, you know, get into mixed martial arts? What was the ultimate reason why you got into the sport of mixed martial arts?
Well, early on, I wrestled in high school. I did very well there. I actually qualified for state, and I broke my neck my senior year. And so they had to do some fusion. A year later, I had lost all my scholarships to play football and wrestling after I broke my neck my senior year. Yeah. About a year and a half later, I ended up putting on about 20 pounds. I got stronger, and then I went played football after I recovered from that. It was at Chester College. I was first-team All-American. We won our division, went to a bowl game. I was most valuable player. So I was very, very active and very talented in sports, and had a lot of opportunity to get involved with a lot of different things. And even like early on in my, before I'd started fighting, I did pro wrestling. I rose to the top in like three different organizations that were smaller organizations, and then an opportunity to get into the UFC.
Going back to the earlier days, sorry, a little bit earlier on, the Lions then, when you set that up, you know, I've talked to your brother, Frank, before in the past, and he said it was, you know, a really brutal place to train. Was it as brutal as people made it out to be? You know, obviously you experienced a lot more in the sport after those days. Is that fair to say that it was a brutal environment?
It was. It was kind of, I got it from Japan, kind of the concept, but they didn't live at houses. They lived actually in the dojo. I actually set up the housing and, you know, basically brought that concept in where I trained fighters for a year. They would live, they would sleep, and they would eat and breathe training.
Yeah.
And what I could put on them in a year or even 6 months with what most people put on in 10 years of training. I had their complete focus, their complete, you know, structure of their life to be able to just hone in on their skills. And it worked because everybody in the Lions, you know, was all Americans, and all every one of them pretty much won their first fight. You know, we had a 99% win ratio with everybody coming out of the Lions and fighting their first time. So the training worked. It was brutal. It had to be brutal because anything that you faced in training would be much easier than what you would face in the ring against another opponent, which gave you a huge advantage.
Mm, definitely. And, you know, I think you've mentioned this in the past that, you know, Frank, you were particularly hard on because you wanted to see him succeed so much. Is that your way of showing love to the guys, you know, and preparing them for, you know, everyday fighting and everyday...
Well, you don't do that today. Now you see there's a lot of people that, and not all of them, some good guys in there, but a lot of people that get in there don't ever reach that level. They have all the skills in the world, but they don't have the work ethic. And you see them fall out. A lot of them fall out after, you know, winning once or twice or you know, getting in there and the level of competition gets stiffer and they got to work harder, but they don't have that work ethic. And you see a lot of them fall aside. You don't see too many sustained champions.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with the training. You know, it becomes so easy to people, you know, because now they can pay a membership or they can get into a gym and learn from a superstar. They don't have to earn it. They don't have to go in and earn it. They can come in and just do it. What we did was we made sure that whoever came into the Lions, especially during that time where it was bare knuckle and no rules, that you had to understand what you were getting into. So nobody came through those doors unless they passed a tryout. And that tryout was the worst thing they would ever go through in their entire life. And if they passed that, then I know that I could train them in this type of environment.
When we spoke to Frank, it said it was the most brutal thing he's ever experienced in his life. Do you believe, obviously, you've had a very, you know, fracturous relationship with Frank. Do you believe the training in the gym possibly had something to do with that? Or was Frank a little bit possibly bitter because of the beatings that you used to dish out upon him?
Oh, no. I honestly think that it had nothing to do with the beatings and it had nothing to do with the training. It had to do with him wanting to be his own person. He came in there, my dad adopted him, took him out of prison, gave him a life. And, you know, I took him into my home. He lived upstairs in my house. I gave him free training, but he had to earn it. He had to make the pass tryouts, and he did that. And so, I paid for everything. You know, even gave him a car. You know, I mean, I gave him everything, training, place to stay, food, clothes. I did that for all the fighters. And for years, I bought in. And because I wanted to be able to give back of things that I had learned, but it wasn't going to come at a point to where people could use me. So they had to earn it. They had to be, you know, some tough guys to get into the Lions Den. And so if they did that, then they had my respect. But that didn't mean that the training got any easier because now we had to get in the ring and we had to fight. So now we were going to do more training in that instead of the fresh guys on them all the time, wearing them out and be basically putting them to a point where they can't win. But when we started training, we put them in situations where they would learn to win.
Yeah. And do you feel as though, you know, the relationship with Frank, because of, you know, he sort of led he went a bit of a liberal lifestyle. Do you think you're very obviously, you base a lot of your training back in the early days on respect. Do you feel as though he disrespected you by, you know, acting the way he did, you know, later on in his career and his disrespect towards Bob? Will you ever forgive him truly for that?
Well, I mean, you know, there's always going to be a spot in there because my dad did pass away and Frank handled that very, very badly. Mm. So, yeah, it is tough, but I believe that you have to forgive in order to move on. So I've got to find that place to be able to store that and forgive. So
definitely.
I'm working on it. You know, it's there, but I still want to do it because I think Frank's going to have his own time and his own place to have to deal with what he did. And it's going to be a lot worse on himself. He's going to be a lot worse on himself than I could be. So I need to get to a spot to where I can forgive him and that we can move forward in our relationship.
Definitely. And we've seen the recent documentary with the two of you guys, you know, sort of, you know, trying to mend the bridges of the relationship. How has it progressed in the last number of months?
Well, you know, I mean, we both have kind of, like I said, we're not fighting, so we're both trying to build another direction for our lives because, one, we didn't have the money that we needed to put away. It just is what it is. So we have to build different businesses. So we're real busy, and we do contact each other through Facebook or email, and occasionally we'll call. So hopefully somewhere in the future we'll get stable. He'll get a little stable. I'll get stable. And we'll be able to set some time aside where we could actually bring families together.
Is it fair to say you've both possibly mellowed in your older years, and that this is a reason that forgive and forget before it's too late?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm the kind of guy, and I've always been that way. Look through my career, where I'm always ready to let go and let things be bygones, because I believe life's too short and you hang on to those things and it just weighs you down as you get older. If you can let them go, your spirit's free. You feel much better not hating people and being angry at people. So I understand that. I learned that early on, that you've got to let things go. And you've got to be able to get along with people that you may not have gotten along with in earlier on. You've got to do that, or you will be so unhappy as life goes on.
Joined on the line here by Kent Shamrock, a mixed martial arts legend. Moving on to a little bit of your career, obviously, you know, Pancrase, you fought there, you fought in the UFC, you fought in Pride, to name but a few. Where was the most rewarding place you've fought, and what was your most memorable memory?
Well, you know, there's a lot of them, and they're all way up there. But my prime was definitely in Japan. I mean, I was young, I was moving, not too many injuries. And then through Japan, I just suffered some injuries towards the end of my career. You know, I was fighting for 2.5 years there. Mm-hmm. And so I sustained some injuries. But I would say that being the first King of Pancras, which is still the same today, I'm still the King of Pancras, the first one. That's history that can't be changed. You know, and then, of course, I got involved with the UFC. You know, I was the very first one.
Yeah.
I helped build the UFC to where it is today. I was the first super fight champion, which was the first ever single fight champion. So all the belts that people have with the single fight go through the very first fight with the super fight champion. That's history. That will never be changed. The second is being able to go into the World Wrestling Federation and being able to have things built around me, being King of the Ring, being Rookie of the Year, even in the MMA world and the WWF world, I was Rookie of the Year. Being King of the Ring, Tag Team Champion, Intercontinental Champion, all in a 2-year period. I accomplished that, all in a 2-year period in the WWF, which probably has never been done. And they built a cage, first guy to go in and have the Lions to match in the WWF. So there are a lot of things that I've done in my career that I'm very proud of. And they all come at certain levels. I know early on, even before I got involved with MMA over in Japan, I went to 2 different wrestling organizations in North Carolina. And in my younger years, I held the belt in both of those. So almost everything that I have ever gotten involved with, I became the champion, the top.
Yeah.
Everything I've, even in football, I became the defensive captain, most valuable player, most inspirational player. So everything that I've ever done, I've really achieved the elite level. And, you know, a lot of that is, you know, God-given talent. And you know, a lot of it I earned through the toughness of being a kid, not having anybody to raise me, and then being able to turn that toughness into something positive.
Speaking of promoters there, you, obviously we know your relationship with Dana White. You don't really have a relationship. You've worked under Vince McMahon and guys like that in the past. Who's the most memorable, or not the most memorable, should I say, but the best promoter you've worked under? And, you know, who do you think, especially in the world of mixed martial arts?
Well, as far as promoters, I really didn't have an issue with anybody other than Dana. Vince McMahon has got some issues, I think. I don't know if it's him. I don't know because I don't know. I thought everything was good, but, you know, I don't know because I would have liked to have gone back in there and tried to achieve capturing that belt in the WWF, but or WWE now, but I don't have that opportunity. No one has reached out. I put the feelers out and let them know that I would love to come back, but no one has actually reached back. So I don't know what the reason is. Obviously, I think that I've done a pretty good job in there. The fans seem to want me back, so yeah, I'm not sure what the reasons are. But, you know, I keep asking, but I don't receive anything. So I guess I'll never find out, but it is what it is. So, but as far as everybody else, Dana, and that, You know, I don't have issues. I think it's more or less people have issues with me. Mm. I'm strong-minded. I'm strong-willed. That's what's got me through life. That's what's helped me reach and achieve almost everything I've ever done, that top level, the elite level of whatever it is I was doing. It was because of those attitudes. But maybe those don't work so well, you know, with dealing with people. I don't know.
You know, I spoke to Art Davey here on the show before, and Art was you know, the time when the Fertittas came in with the money, and Dana was obviously their head guy. He said if Bob Merowitz or, you know, someone else had put the money behind him and Campbell McLaren, that, you know, they would have taken the promotion to the next level. How do you think, or where do you think the UFC would be now if it would have been someone like Art Davey or Campbell McLaren, you know, heading the show? Do you think it would be a very different picture to what we see now?
Well, who knows? You know, I mean, business is business. You know, there's always going to be people that are going to be angry because of the way people do business sometimes. But my problem is it seems like nowadays that everybody that comes to the end of their career, it's being disrespected, is not being let go properly, being treated with absolutely no respect. And so it's just becoming a trend that those things are happening. If you have a strong mind and strong will, which most guys do when they're able to achieve at these levels, they have to be. But then there are some of them who really don't want or don't care anymore, or just, you know, they're just done, are okay with being puppets, you know, saying yes or no, sir. But guys that really have their independency and strength and strong-willed, those guys don't deal well with being told that they're washed up or that they're done and being disrespected when they're being let go. They don't deal well with that. And that's what's happening, is that they need to put somebody else in place to deal with these guys when they're done. Not somebody like Dana, who has absolutely no respect towards the fighters when they're done.
And do you think it's, you know, a case of the company guys are possibly, you know, ruining the way fighters are getting treated these days? Because, you know, you've guys, obviously, we can name our company guys, the list goes on. I think everyone knows who they are. There's no point to use names. But I think it's guys like this that are really setting the precedent to the way, you know, the general, you know, prelim fighter to the main card fighter are being treated.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it goes by how they're being treated, when they're let go. And it may not even be such a big deal if you realize that these guys were actually getting paid something. You know, I'm not saying all of them. Some of these guys made some pretty decent money, but not what they should have made when it came to the numbers. And I looked at it like this: when you're being the face of the company, where everybody's coming to see you, that company owes you an honorable business offer, not something to where you say you make $1 million, and most people go, well, that's a lot of money, you should be happy. Okay, but if somebody in another business helps build this business to what it is, even though they don't own it, and they move up the ranks and they get pay raises to a point to where they're at a place where they're making a lot of money because of what they're doing, and they sit down and negotiate every deal that they get, knowing what the numbers are, and negotiating a good price for this guy to stay because they need him, or he'll leave and go to another company. The problem is that we can't sit down and negotiate with these guys for the right amount of number because there's no other business to go to. So, therefore, these guys are taking $1 million shot when they're making 50 or 100 million on the show, and not even including the merchandise that they're selling, not including the international sales of pay-per-view. So what's the number that these guys should be making for real, considering that they're the ones building the business at that moment for the UFC? It's a partnership right now. Definitely. I am the guy that is making them money right now. They are using my name, my sweat, my blood, my tears to make money right now. And in a while, it won't be that way, but right now, I'm the guy they're making money with. If that's the truth, then we become a partner in this business, or I can go to another place and make more money. But the problem is that they can't go to another place to make money, so therefore, they have to stay and take what they get, and it's not fair all the way down the card.
Cannon, you know more about this than I would, obviously. About, you know, you'd see, you know, your fights probably now on you know, Fight Pass and, you know, past UFC events regarding, you know, royalties for you, etc., to have your name, you know, on their Fight Pass product. You know, what's the situation with that? And do you think possibly it's because earlier on in your career you were naive to the contracts you were signing? Or how did that come about? Is there anything that you can do to get your name removed from the UFC?
Well, I'd early on, when I first came back from Japan, they were having problems. I mean, they were getting ready to shut the doors. Tito Ortiz was the guy that they were, you know, putting the company on. Unfortunately for Tito, he really didn't have anybody to be across from him to help build those pay-per-view numbers. So when I came back, I was 38 years old, 36 or 38, I don't remember which one it was, but I was definitely out of my prime when I went back over to Pride in Japan. Went to pro wrestling first, did that for a while at WWE, then left, then went to Pride, had three fights over there. So I was really way out of my prime, but I came back to the UFC because the numbers were drizzled. I mean, there were 37,000 buys with Tito headlining the show with whoever they brought in, and they just could not get the numbers. So I told Dana when he came to me, he asked me, and I finally said, okay, but I've got knee problems, and, you know, I'll do it this time, but afterwards I'm going to have to get them fixed. So I go in there, and I told Dana, I will get the numbers. I'll break the 100,000 mark. He goes, yeah, everybody keeps saying that, but nobody does. And I said, I'm telling you, I will. I said, I've got a cross-market here between mainstream audience with the WWE, WWF at the time, and over in Japan with Pride, and also with the UFC when I was there. So when I come in, the numbers were going to jump. I promise you, it only makes sense. He goes, okay. So we agreed upon something of over 99,000 buys. I would get paid extra money because he couldn't pay me what I wanted, and I made a deal with him. Well, if I do that, then I get so much over 100,000 buys. I live by what I say. He agreed to it. And so we went in and did it, and when the show was over, we blew it up. I mean, it went mainstream, you know, it went best damn sports show. I mean, everybody wanted to do the interviews, and it went viral. You know, and of course I was struggling with training, and I knew I was going to have a brutal time, but I knew that I could bring the UFC to where it needed to be to live and keep my legacy alive. And so I did that. And came back, and Dana told me that we did 99,000 buys. Yeah. That was my fault, because I didn't really think a guy after that, because he was so excited, he even stood there. He said, I can't believe this. People going. He was so excited. And I said, see, I told you I could do this. I know how to do this. And he was goes, man, this is just great, man. The numbers are awesome. I said, oh, great, you know. And then after this fight was over, he came and told me, man, he was really good. He did 99,000 buys. I didn't think a guy would lie to me after doing what we did. I was standing there thinking in my mind, man, I thought we did more than that. I know the gate was unbelievable. You know, it was $1 million gate. And so I didn't do anything for the gate, but I knew the audience was crazy. I knew we went mainstream. And I was like, well, you know, 50 something thousand buys more than what they were doing is a pretty good sized number, but I was disappointed. I really thought I could have broke the numbers. Well, 6 months down the road, after I'd already signed a contract for a multi-fight deal with them, which excluded, this is why I can't do anything, which excluded anything that was in the previous contract. That's what screwed me. Because at 6 months after that, I found out what the numbers were. And it was over, people tell me it was over 150,000, but we're going to go minimum of 150,000 buys. So right there is when my problem started with Dana, was because he lied to me. He straight up lied to me.
Saying that about Dana, obviously you guys don't get on well. It's well publicized. Is there any positive characteristics in your opinion of Dana White?
Well, when I first met Dana, he seemed like a very personable guy, just like what his mother said. His mother said Dana was a very likable person. Everybody loved him. That's the guy I knew. Mm. When I came in, he was very, very, he was a guy that could really make anybody feel at ease. And, you know, so I felt great. I thought he was good for the business and a great personality, dealt with people well. And then I saw this change, you know, it was like this greed took over. Mm. And, you know, he's just not that same guy I met. I promise you that.
And talking to Dana yet again, obviously we've seen the whole uniform, you know, the UFC are talking about bringing in this uniform where the fighters won't be able to get their sponsors on their trunks, etc. But Dana has come out and said today, you know, his exact words, there's no fucking deal in place to do this. If it's very much rumoured amongst the mixed martial arts media, this is going to happen. What's your opinion on this? Is this just another way of, you know, devaluing the marketability and the financial ambitions of mixed martial artists?
Well, Dana threw that out there, and he was hoping he wouldn't get so much flack for it, because it is. The thought process wants to be able to control fighters more. And now that there's a huge outcry on that, he doesn't want to give any more footing to what we have said, which is it's too late. I mean, I think most people realize what's going on. This guy got caught up into a whirlwind, and he doesn't know who he is anymore. And the people that are closest to him don't know who he is anymore.
Do you think Dana's,
he doesn't know who he is anymore?
Do you think Dana's delusional?
I do. I think you see spots of it where you're like, did he just say that? And I think most people stand back and look and think, did he just say that? I really believe that he's getting the Mike Tyson syndrome. And, you know what happens when that happens. You know, the strongest people in the world today are fans. They are the strongest entity in anything in the world,
of course, yeah,
that we have going. Because all they have to do is say, we've had enough. And it's over.
Is there any sort of regret now, the way you've seen the UFC progress onto a mainstream level? Is there any regret that you ever actually fought within the UFC to be associated with them now, because you intensely hate, I think it's fair to say, what Dana White has done with the company?
When I first came back, I was out of my prime. I had injuries. I had screws in my neck. I was out of my prime, but I thought that I could go in there, and I thought I could still win. There's no question. I figured I could find a way to win. I've always been able to do that. But you don't realize, you know, when you get older and stuff like that, that you're just not that same person anymore. It takes you a while to figure it out. But I thought I could get fixed, get surgeries, and continue to keep going. So I did the fight with Tito, and, you know, by all means, I was not where I should have been, but I still thought I could win. And it didn't turn out that way. But the reason why I did it, the reason why I came back to the UFC, was because Dana White asked me to. He asked me to come back. And so I did. And I told him I could do these numbers. And I did. And I got punched in the nuts. Literally, punched in the nuts. Mm. Can't breathe because of what they did to me. And I don't. And for me, I can let that go. I didn't do anything about it. That's on me. That's on me. Mm. And I have absolutely nowhere to complain. And that's what I keep trying to tell these fans when they say, oh, why are you guys in crying? I spilled over milk. And you should have saved your money. You should have done this. You know what? I accept the responsibility of what happened to me. This isn't about me. This is about moving forward and trying to fix what's happening, because there are going to be more people like me. And I would hate to see that.
Yeah. And we've seen more recently, obviously, we know that GSP has sort of, you know, halted his career a little bit and taken an indefinite time of absence. And he criticized the UFC for a numerous amount of things after that. Do you think fighters are, you know, taking a stand now possibly against the UFC? And is it something you'd like to see more fighters, you know, possibly do? Obviously, we've learned in the last week that Gilbert Melendez might be on his way to Bellator, probably the best, I think it's fair to say, the uncrowned UFC lightweight champion. Would you like Gil to go to Bellator to sort of make a statement to see the UFC, they don't have it all their own way? Because I think generally conceived amongst the mixed martial arts media that, you know, Gil is probably the best lightweight in the world.
Well, I would say this. I would say that it would be nice to see guys you know, take a stand, but I'm not sure that's going to happen right at this point, because there's really nowhere to go for them to make the money that they would make at the UFC. Mm. So I understand where they're at. I really do. It would be nice to be able to see everybody stand together and not one individual have to make that decision. Because then at that point, UFC has no choice but to listen. Mm. Or Dana White might jump up and down and say, effing this and effing that. If you effing fighters go there, you effing fighters do this, and you effing fighters do that, I will effing shut this company down.
Just a few more questions before we wrap it up, and I really do appreciate the time, Ken. Do you admire any of the guys, or do you dislike some of the characters, like, you know, company guys? Like, do you think these guys are good for the sport, or, you know, are they potentially ruining the future of mixed martial arts?
It's not their issue. I mean, most people say,
you know, but do you think they should possibly stand up and make an issue, because there's no one seems to be standing up and doing it that's actually an active fighter within the promotion at the moment?
Well, let me tell you this. If I was in their position, I would have a hard time standing up unless I knew the rest of them would stand up.
Is Gilbert Melendez not doing that at the moment, though, to a certain extent?
Gilbert Melendez has got an opportunity to go somewhere else and make more money. Yeah. John Jones don't have that opportunity. He's getting paid pretty good right now. Not what he should be making as opposed to what he's bringing in. He's not even getting paid 1% of what he's bringing in for them. Mm. That's my point. Is that he ain't going to make that kind of money. Now, Dana makes it really clear that a lot of these guys will not make that kind of money anywhere else. But at the same time, if you look at the numbers that they're bringing in, they're getting raped.
Just another issue that's, you know, it's on the horizon of mixed martial arts the whole time at the moment is testosterone replacement therapy. And we've recently heard you speak out, you know, admitting that you used steroid in the past, not going into a fight. Do you think it's you know, a change of the times, the fact guys are, you know, obviously using the TRT now. Was it steroids very much back in the day? Is there a similar sort of pattern the way things have gone, but with different substances, obviously?
Well, it is. You know, it's just like boxing. When you look at boxing, there's so many ways for you to hide the drug testing, especially when they come out. This is what really makes it funny, because they come out and announce when they're going to test you. And it's almost like you think that and most people are ignorant to it, but do you understand what they're doing? They're saying, I'm going to test you. We're going to test you at this time. And we're going to test for steroids before the fight, just before the fight when you're in the locker room. And then we're going to test for any other substances like pot, painkillers, anything after you come out of the ring. I mean, they basically give you a time and date and schedule when they're going to do it. I think any mastermind would be able to figure out a way to cheat.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, doing it the way if they were serious about cleaning it up, you would do blood tests. And if guys couldn't stand needles, which most of them will all of a sudden come up with ways of saying, well, I don't want to get stuck with a needle. Then you do random pee testing throughout the training time. Anytime they come in, right then on the spot, they walk in the door. You may be in the ring right at that time. You got to stop right then and there. They walk in the bathroom, make you a pee test. They can do that two or three times during that. If they really were serious about cleaning it up. Problem is that they're just looking at ways to make money. I mean, if you look at the way they test all the guys that are in the main event, or no matter where they're at on the car, the guy that's making the most money, they'll test him. Because they figure if they can catch one of these guys that are doing this, which is, you know, pretty dumb anyways, because if guys have a lot of money, they have ways of cheating. They figure out ways of cheating. So it doesn't make any sense to me. It's a ridiculous system. You know, a lot of guys who would actually test it positive, you look at it and go, really? Like Hoyce Gracie. Yeah. You know, when you've got other big monsters on the show that you look at and you go, yeah, maybe they are, maybe they're not, but you look at it and you go, well, they look like they are. And you look at Hoyce Gracie and he testified, you're like, really? That's your system?
And Ken, when you were taking the steroids, I know you admitted there recently that you did, was it, you know, 6 months before a fight, before you even got into camp? You know, the way guys, you know, use the TRT at the moment, they use it obviously a good bit beforehand to get their levels down. Was it a case of adjusting? And was it in sort of preparation for training before the fight that you would you juice up on this?
Well, I didn't get involved with steroids. Growth hormones was what I used because basically, when you get older, your hormones go down, your testosterone level go down, so you use the hormonal things to put it back up to normal levels. And in the new UFC, when the Fajitas took over and they started drug testing, and you could see the change in my body. when I fought Tito the first time. I was 200 pounds. I was 198 pounds, 200 pounds. And throughout the whole UFC, you never weighed over 207 pounds. Prior to that, you could see my body's changed from Japan fighting where I weighed 205 pounds, sometimes 217. In the UFC, I was 217, sometimes 220.
Yeah.
But I never, ever stepped in the ring on roids, ever. So, there are ways to get around this. And that's the thing, is it's so stupid with what they're trying to do. They know it, too. They know it.
Do you think, obviously, it's well documented as well. A lot of guys come out and said, 90% of guys even
Listen,
now at the
I
moment.
I want to say something before that. Ask that question too, is that I don't have a problem with people using hormones because I think, personally, in my opinion, I think that you can go to a doctor and you can get amounts of hormones put in your body that is healthy for your body. And it helps recovery, it helps your body get stronger and recover faster. Steroids, I think, they're bad because they don't have anything to really do with sports and longevity for life. But hormone medicines do. And I think that they're making it more dangerous by not letting these guys be able to go to a doctor, get on some medicine, hormonal medicines that will bring their levels up for a man at a normal level, or maybe a little above a normal level, where they, how they test right now, where they test for normal levels. They can do the same thing. They can't be on it unless they're under a doctor's care. And if they are on it, then the doctors need to test them and be able to give them levels of where they're at before they fight so that they can go in there at a normal level. To me, it takes away the danger of what we have today, where guys are getting it on the black market, they're taking whatever they can, and then they're getting themselves into a problem where they're depressed. You see them shrunk up and look sick after they're done. If they would just do this thing right and said, you know what, these guys are like an Indy race car. They're driving hard, not like a street car. So they need high octane fuel, and they need to change the parts of the engine every race. They need to change it because they don't want anything to blow up. So I look at the fighters the same way, is they're running hard every day. Their bodies are pushed to the highest limit, and they're asked to do this every day to stay in shape. And then when fight time comes around, they're asked to go to another level.
Yeah.
Well, in order for you to be able to continue to do this for a long period of time, you need hormonal medicines to be able to keep your body, to be able to recover hard every day, to be able to perform at a high level. But at the same time, you could test those levels being under a doctor's care to make sure that you're not at a high level to where it could be dangerous for you. This way, you're not getting the fighters, because they're going to use it. If there's a way to cheat, they'll find a way to use it. And I say, open the doors. Let it be legalized. If they're going to legalize pot, for God's sake, which I think is a lot worse for you than hormonal medicine, the hormone medicine that you use, not hormonal, hormone medicine for men, like growth hormone, testosterone, those type of things that boost your normal levels up to somewhere where you're 22. But you're not at a dangerous level where you're going to hurt yourself, and that is where the doctors come in, being under a doctor's care. Doctors will not lie about what they're doing for their athletes, because they will lose their license, because at any moment they could test these guys and find out whether their levels are where the doctor says they are or aren't. And if they're not, doctors would lose their license.
Well, are the promotions doing enough to regulate this, or is it the governing state bodies? Should it be more done by both sides? Get this out of the sport, or to just regulate it to some degree?
Well, yeah, I do. I think that you've got two ways to go. Either one, you make an effort to stop it, and you make that you don't, throw sugar on it and catch somebody every now and then and say you're doing your job, because that's ridiculous.
Of course.
And then they catch guys that don't know how to use it, like Hoyce Gracie, who doesn't know how to hide it. It has to do it because Soccer Robert, changes his blood and, whatever it is that the medical people do for him. And he comes in and he's fighting a guy who's at a normal level and he beats him. But Hoyce Gracie says, okay, well, I'm going to even the playing field. And he goes in and then he beats Sakuraba. Well, then he comes up, because he doesn't know how to cheat, and he comes up positive. Well, you got some guys on there that's 250 pounds, cut down to 220 and shredded. And you're going, okay, he got caught and he didn't. There's a difference of guys who know how to cheat and guys that don't know how to cheat.
What's your, just before we wrap it, I'm sorry for keeping you way over time here, Ken. Obviously, guys, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we know about Vitor Belfort's past. How do you perceive guys like this, you know, fighting up against, you know, other guys that have, you know, completely clean records? Do you believe these guys should be regulated in these states? And do you believe they should be given the opportunity to fight for world titles after, you know, testing positive for steroids in the past?
Well, listen, in my opinion, I think that the testing is a joke, okay? And I think that you ask any fighter, they'll tell you the same thing. The thing I don't like is when other fighters point out that somebody else is using, and then you look at them and go, really?
Yeah.
You know, nobody's telling the truth. So many people are lying about what they're doing. And the ones that use you are the ones that are pointing fingers at other people because they lost.
Yeah.
So it's really, everybody's using something, you know, just like some people want to smoke pot because it helps them relax after training or before training or calm the nerves or whatever it is. That's also a way to gain an advantage. I don't care what anybody says. It is. It's like, you know, when Babe Ruth used to get drunk all the time and he would go on the baseball park, he'd hit home runs. Take the beer away, could he do the same thing? If not, it's an advantage.
Mm. Do you believe mixed martial arts is completely, you know, riddled with steroids at the moment?
Well, you know, like I said, I think there are some good athletes out there, but I'm saying that there's a very, very high percentage of people using and lying about it.
Is there current?
If you're not using, you should have enough confidence in yourself to go in there and do your job. And if by chance someone does beat you and he looks like it's on, the more that you raise about somebody being on, the more it doesn't look right. Even though I understand, you know, what you're going through, you know, for God's sake, I know because I went in and fought and I was 200 pounds, 202 pounds and 205 pounds and I was getting beat by guys that were walking in after weighing at 205 at 220, 230 pounds. So I understand, but you don't say anything because you can't prove it.
Do you believe there's current world champions using performance-enhancing drugs at the moment?
You know, I mean, I would believe so. But again, like I said, it's the same thing. I mean, I believe there's a high percentage of people using it and people are lying about it, which, you know, if they do tell, obviously they're going to lose the title or they're going to lose their place in MMA. So, you know, I mean, it's like, do or don't you tell? And so like I said, that's on them. You know, my conscience is clear, but it's on them on what they need to do. But I would say there's a very high percentage of that. And I think it has to go back to the thought process of guys who are going in there and they're realizing that if they don't, they're not going to get an opportunity to win. So it's, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You know, if you go in there and you stay, you know, clean, and you've got great talent, and you go in there against somebody that isn't, and he beats you in a decision, and you know, okay, well, if it was fair and fair, I would have submitted him.
But
because they were on, you know, it's not fair. But so then they go and say, you know what, I'm going to fix that problem. So they go out there and they figure out how to use and how to cheat, and they go on, and then they go in there, and they destroy everybody, and you know, and they're like, yes. See, now look, but they can't say anything and they got to lie about it. So I understand the process of why it's getting so spotted in there was because people are constantly going up against people that are using. They know it in their own minds and they are not, and they get beat. They haven't even made it up the ranks yet and they're getting beat. So they say, well, if I'm going to make it in this sport, I've got to go on. And so you see my point? It's like, you know, it's like if you want to make it in MMA, you need to rethink where you're going and how you're doing it.
Definitely.
Unless they fix it.
That's the real point. It really does need to be sorted out on a global level. Just a couple of quick fire questions before we wrap it up. How is everything going with the bodyguards, the ProTech Global Service? How's that been working out for you, Ken?
It's going great, man. I've been opportunity to get a lot of celebrity clients and it's been a great run for me. So hopefully it'll keep going.
Definitely. And what does 2014 hold for Ken Shamrock? What are we going to see Ken Shamrock involve himself in this year?
Well, we got a couple of reality shows that we've been working on for a while now, so they're starting to pan out. Like I said, there's still a long ways to go. You know, we got to get through selling it and seeing you know, different stations if they want to pick it up and stuff like that. So we're in the process of doing that. I also got a sports drink out called Shamrock Slam.
Brilliant.
If you want to go and find out how to order it, it's called ShamrockSlam.com. It'll give you all the information you need on there. Also, too, I have a online self-defense classes that you can take. And it's ProFit101.com. ProFit101.com. You can go on there and check out the online self-defense classes. And the big thing is I really built my Twitter up. It's at ShamrockKen.
Yeah, I've noticed you're very active on the Twitter to responding to your fans as well.
Yeah, I do. So anybody wants to go on there, I'm on there every day. Come on and chat with us. It's at ShamrockKen. I'd love to hear from you guys. But anyways, I appreciate you having me on.
Brilliant. I really do appreciate the time. And just one more question for you.
What's that?
Any other words to your good friend and pal, Dana White? Anything else you'd like to get off your chest about Dana?
Well, like I said, I have nothing with Dana or the Fajitas. It has to do with the way these fighters are making money.
Yeah.
And I've said this over and over again. If I'm wrong and the monies aren't being made like I think they're being made, then prove me wrong and I will go on TV anywhere you want me to and apologize for being wrong. Mm-hmm. But if not, we need to fix it. That's it. There's no anger, no hurt, no, you know, I have no hard feelings towards any of them, even already what they've done. That was my thing. I didn't fix it. That's my business, my problem. But moving forward, I would love to see these guys be able to, after they're done for three to however long years they've got in there, that they walk away with something, you know, enough to them to feel pretty comfortable.
Brilliant stuff, Ken. I'm really sorry about keeping you way over time here. And listen, I really do appreciate the time and you coming on the show. And I'd love to do it again sometime in the future.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And that was Ken Shamrock. Big thanks to Ken for taking quite some time out. I actually only scheduled that interview for 20 minutes, but we went on it for 45 plus, I think. Some really interesting stuff. And Andrew, just speaking with Ken there, he thinks Dana White is delusional. Is that a fair comment or assessment to make of Dana White?
I think Ken is just always going to have a bad relationship with Dana White in a couple of years, but I don't know. People are always going to have bad experiences with people and
a really interesting guy, really interesting character, obviously having, you know, sort of checkered past with his brother, who we've also had on the show here before, Frank. But big thanks to Ken again for taking the time out, and some really interesting points on the fighter pay. He believes the fighters are treated like crap, a lot of them, by the Ultimate Fighting Championships. So there's a lot of rumors about this potential clothing deal that the UFC are going to sign, where they're not going to allow fighters, have their sponsors on their trunks, etc. And Andrew, what's your opinion on that as well? It's, you know, they seem to be, what can I say, denying, fighters of making, financial gains outside of the octagon.
Yeah, well, the rumors that you see on Twitter that you can never be sure if they're true or not is that apparently some fighters have to pay a sponsor tax, some others don't. Mm. And then some sponsors have no interest in paying a sponsor tax to the UFC, so then other fighters are losing sponsors.
Yeah.
From that then, losing sponsors obviously means less money. Are the UFC going to offer more money to fighters if they're going to make them wear a uniform? I know that the UFC recently did bring in, like, much to Dan Henderson's distaste, like a code where, like, you can't wear flip-flops, you can't wear fight shorts and stuff like that when you're on press tours and obligations. And whether it follows through, you just hope that they're going to compensate for fighters perhaps what they've missed. But then again, they can't really, because, like, if they say to John Jones, you can't wear that Gatorade or Knight logo, that could be for a lot of money. But if they ask Prelim X, oh, you can't wear that, like, for your local gun shop, might only be something like two grand, you know what I mean? Yeah. Maybe they'd pay that. They're not going to pay the money that, say, Jones or something like that could be getting from for the big sponsors.
And that's another thing I mentioned to Ken Shamrock, you know, the company guys like John Jones, who obviously have Nike sponsorships. He sort of, to a certain extent, mentioned there that, you know, these guys are, you know, sort of, he can't really blame them for what they're doing, but, you know, someone needs to sort of possibly stand up and you know, make a call. To help out the guys, you know, that would be your regular sort of prelim fighter.
Yeah, you wonder, like, as a fighter, like, it's very easy for us to sit on the outside.
Yeah, definitely,
but we don't know what those fighters actually get. We know what officially they get paid, but...
Yeah, there's a lot of...
Like, Rampage, bonuses. Dana said, made almost $16 million in the UFC. Mm. But if you added up all of his purses, it wasn't $16
million. Yeah.
Yeah, so he obviously did get a lot in bonuses and a lot in sponsorship as well. And Dana says he has all that figures. The UFC know how much fighters make. And I think the reason they aren't standing out so much is that you have some guys like who Jason Young was commenting on Facebook, was commenting how bad it was the other day. And like that's because he's from the outside again looking, and maybe things have improved since then.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that the UFC are great and they're paying everyone what they deserve to be paid. But until like one of our close friends who's willing to talk about financial details like that tells us what top UFC earners and stuff like that make,
nothing can't resolved.
Exactly, we don't know the full facts.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a hard one to call, but obviously, you know, I have to mention it with Ken because of his recent comments. And
I wonder if they'll unionize. There's been talk of
that's union. You know, that's been talked about for a long time. It obviously would be for especially the guys, you know, on the prelim cards that spend a lot of their time on the prelim cards and lower down on the cards, would be a great thing for these guys. But as we mentioned there, the guys at the top of the divisions, you know, they won't want that. You know, they're not going to stand up and speak out against it because you know, they're earning some big bucks.
Exactly, and why would they support the prelim guys just because they may not have the same talent or ability as they have, same pulling power?
It's yeah,
you
know,
you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you, especially if you're being fed very well.
Exactly, that's 100% true, and you know, it's just one of these things that I think it's we'll obviously see this situation evolve in the coming years, and we'll see what happens. Okay, moving on a bit before we finish up here today. Nate Diaz, interesting tweet from him last night. He asked Dana White, could he be released from his UFC contract? What's you know, the Diaz brothers? You know, what's Nate's, you know, issue here? What do you feel he's trying to? Obviously, he said he wanted a title shot, but you know, why put out a tweet like that?
Maybe he feels like he isn't, or he's been told he's not going to get the title shot, that he's been offered fights.
Well, should he really get the title shot anyway? No, I don't think so. Do you?
I don't know. I know Gareth A. Davis made a bit of a fool of himself at the press conference last week by suggesting that Nick Diaz should get a title shot, which is just ludicrous. And I know Dana did fairly go to town in that answer a little bit, or the question a little bit. But he... I did think Nate has probably done enough to warrant a title shot in normal circumstances. Unfortunately, the normal circumstances don't include the lightweight division being so stacked. The fact that one of his best friends and training partners is now going to be fighting Anthony Pettis for the title shot. And maybe Nate Diaz knows that he's so high up in the division. There's two theories I have.
But he's lost two of his last three fights. Like, why do you get a title shot off the back of that?
A Diaz is a Diaz. Like, Nate, you know the way the Diaz brothers have a thing saying that, I think Nick put it up on Instagram recently, sometimes you win fights.
Yeah, I know, yeah. But
having lost them, and sometimes you lose fights. Like, I thought
Carlos Condit situation.
He pushed Ben Henderson. Like, Ben obviously won that fight, was KO'd by Josh Thompson, but he finished Gray Maynard fairly fucking, like,
yeah, but
easily.
Let's look at Gray Maynard. Gray Maynard as well is a guy who's looked very, very, you know, he's taken so many big hits in his last three or four fights that, you know, let's be honest, I think Gray's on the back burner of his career.
Yeah, I don't know, I could have seen him getting another title shot, to be honest, but... I'm looking at it now from two points of view, especially from Nate Diaz's. number one, best friends with Gilbert Melendez. He knows that Gilbert Melendez has been in a contract and battle with the UFC, and he has just signed a new deal, great pay, and he's getting pay-per-view points, and he has to be on the main card or something like that for all of his fights, or he has to be main or co-main in any fight that he's going to be fighting in. And the fact that he's getting pay-per-view points is a big thing as well. Massive. Nate Diaz, both of the Diazes are a big draw. Maybe when renegotiation times come around, they're going to be looking for something similar.
And Gail is on the Ultimate Fighter as well.
Exactly. The other hand of this is going to be that Melendez is now in the Ultimate Fighter. He's going to be fighting Pettis sometime in December or November. Yeah. It means that Nate probably knows that, or will think that, Gilbert Melendez is going to beat Pettis. He's not going to ever fight Gilbert Melendez for obvious reasons. The Scrap Pack Caesar Gracie fighter team is just a historic one in mixed martial arts. And he might see money in Bellator. He might have heard about the money that Melendez was being offered by Bellator, and he's like, I want some of that. Yeah. Especially if I'm not going to be able to fight for the UFC title, I might as well fight for some money. So I don't know. Those Diazes fight for money. They fight for the love of fighting as well, I have to say. But like, Diaz didn't want to fight with Khabib Nurmagomedov because, in all honesty, he was probably going to be wrestled and he was probably going to be beat. And Diaz doesn't like fighting like that. Mm. And
stand-up wars is what these guys love.
Exactly. And I think Nate Diaz just kind of waited too long. You know what I mean? He probably could have taken another fight that would have guaranteed him title contention that wasn't Khabib Nurmagomedov, but he held out assuming he'd be getting the shot from Pettis. And at the same time, the Diaz brothers are big names, and I don't think Dana White or the Fertittas or the UFC brand would actually want to lose them. So I wouldn't be surprised. Like, wasn't Nate on something like 15-15 for his last fight? Dana then did explain it, though, due to the bonuses. Like, Nate Diaz isn't crying poverty, although all the Diazes do, both the Diazes do. It's because you have to pay 10% towards your coach or your fight, your manager or your team and stuff like that. But that's only of your disclosed pay. So he only has to pay 10% of 30 grand if he wins, or obviously 1,500 if he loses, but still gets his show money, not including his bonuses, which I assume he can keep for himself.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, going to be interesting to see what happens there. I do agree with Andrew. I think he's possibly holding out, like the Gill situation, to try and get a better deal off the UFC. Going to be interested to see what happens in the next few weeks. Just a couple more bits, Andrew, before we wrap it up. The UFC UK announced a new partnership with Channel 5. It's a strange one. We haven't really learned any more details. I got the email off the UFC yesterday about it. Will this piss off potentially a lot of guys who have paid for the subscription to BT Sports, now that this is going to be, you know, free to air on Channel 5 in the UK? What's the situation?
Well, I did a bit of sniffing. What I've learned is that
you did a bit of sniffing. Where?
All fights. Shut up. All fights that are recorded in the US, intended for US distribution or EMEA cards, are exclusive to BT Sport. However, anything that is for Fight Pass, which this card is, the main card can be shown on Channel. I believe there actually is only going to be 3 or 4 fights shown on Channel 5. And like Simon Head, who works for BT Sport, put up, if I still work for the Mirror, I would be writing a headline that says why this move is good for BT Sport and for Channel 5. First of all, it's great. Obviously, I assume the UFC have a deal where, if they're on a network, they're the only mixed martial arts promotion on a network. So I assume Bama have been bent over and just thrown right out the door, Channel 5, now that they have the UFC. So Bama's gone. Rumors that Cage Warriors are going to be on terrestrial TV by the end of the year on Channel 4 as well. They're circulating around since this announcement. And it just means the UFC are going to get more fans, or maybe introduce themselves to a newer audience, who will then in turn subscribe to
BT Sport.
BT Sport. Callum Leslie had a great interview with Gary Cook, a sit-down interview back in January, and he said, Cook said he'd love to see the UFC on terrestrial TV, and he thinks it may be closer than we had thought. So obviously this has been going on for a while, but
yeah, it's going to be interesting how it works out. But you know, I haven't really gone around Twitter and seen the reaction to the fans yet, but I'm sure there's a few people that might be a little bit pissed off with this. Obviously, it's going to be the EMEA events, but you know, let's see what happens with this. It is, it's good news, obviously, to you know, spread the word of the sport, which is, I think, is first and foremost on most people's radar over this side of the pond anyway.
So yeah, exactly.
It's great news, and you know, really looking forward to that card next week. Andrew, just before we wrap it up today, any plans for the weekend? Obviously, Cage Warriors we have on Saturday night. I'll see you down there anyway.
Yeah, big, fairly busy. Well, weekend Saturday, I have no college on Fridays. I'm working tonight. I'm working tomorrow night. Then up very early Saturday morning for Grapplepalooza. Then straight over to Cage Warriors. And then straight back to Dundalk to DJ at the 21st.
Jesus, you're a busy man.
Busy man. No rest. No rest for the wicked.
What time are you DJing? Will you get back to Dundalk in time for that?
Well, you see, the deal is it's in a house. Hopefully I'll be back by about 12 o'clock and then I'll play till about 3:30. So that'll be grand.
And what sort of music do you play, Andrew?
I've only really played 21sts, and I'm a big fan of all the EDM music, Hardwell and Alesso and different stuff like that.
Teeny bopper.
Teeny bopper.
Yeah, you like all that sort of music.
You see, Niall, you don't play what you like, you play what the crowd likes.
Oh, you're a smart arse, McGann. Obviously, you can catch Andrew on severemma.com, and you can catch him on Twitter at AndrewMcGann_. And you catch us on Twitter at TBMMADOTCOM and at NileMcGrath4. And obviously, subscribe on the iTunes, all that stuff. And obviously, on the website as well, TalkingBrawlsMMA.com. And TuneIn Radio, as I mentioned as well, it's a great app. So download that on your iPhone or your Samsungs or whatever, and you can catch that. It's a really, really good app. All the best podcasts in the world of mixed martial arts are on that. Andrew, listen, always great to have you on the show, my friend. Hopefully next week, guys, we'll have I'm trying to organise at the moment. Obviously, we've had Jimmy Manu on the show a number of times, and a couple of the other guys on the card next week. So I'll be back, I think, on possibly Monday or Tuesday with the next edition of the podcast. No live show this week. I'm going to do a live show possibly next Sunday after I get back from the UK, flying over on Thursday. So really looking forward to that one as well. So yeah, do catch the fights this weekend. Obviously, we have Cage Warriors on Saturday night. That will be on irishmma.com. Is that right, Andrew?
IrishMMA.tv.
That will be on. Obviously, MMA Junkie for the rest of the world. And then you can catch it on Satanta Sports 1 here in Ireland. And just check Cage Warriors for the listing times and all. And as I mentioned as well, if you haven't got your ticket, get your tickets along to that, because there's a few remaining. So do get them quick if you're listening in here today. And obviously, UFC is on live on Fight Pass. I believe it's going to be replayed on BT Sport, I think 9 p.m. I'm not too sure about that. Check your local listings. But it's going to be on Fight Pass at 11:45 GMT, I think. 7:45 Eastern time in the States. So obviously get on board that as well. Andrew, can't wait for the weekend here myself. Absolutely buzzing for the fights on Saturday night.
And you're forgetting as well, we'll be doing something live over in London as well. Yeah. Or not live, but we'll be recording something over in London.
We'll be recording something in London big time. 110% we will be. I think I might have my microphones back yet, so I'm just waiting to sort that out. I won't mention any names. But anyway, listen, guys, as always, really do appreciate you listening. And from Andrew McGahan and myself, it is a...
goodbye. Oh, Gillick.
Ah, Jesus, Andrew, can't wait.
Gillick.
All right, guys, thanks a million. It's good luck and good night. Cheers, thanks a million.
Broadcasting from Dublin, Ireland, and around the world on TalkingBrawlsMMA.com and iTunes. You're listening to Ireland's premier mixed martial arts show, the Talking Brawls Mixed Martial Arts Podcast.
This is Mike Dolce,
Ian McCall, James Little Evil Pulver,
the Crippler Chris Leaving, and you're listening to
Talking Brawls.